Thank you, Chuck. Our first presenter tonight is going to be Jimmy DeYoung. And you're with, I already forgot, prophecytoday.com. I remember that part. Ministries. And I've been listening to Jimmy, you know, every week on Brandon House's show. And I've learned a lot about this guy. You know, I mean, he ran a radio station in New York. He ran for politics back before the moral majority ever got going. And he, of course, has done all kinds of things like work with Day of Discovery, Young Life, and various other men. Ran a radio station in New York City? Yeah, in New York City, a Christian radio station for many years. And has a deep love for Israel, and has lived in Israel for about a dozen years, and has a lot of information. So, Jimmy, come on. I'm looking forward to hearing you tonight. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. As I get up here, I have to confess immediately. The entire 2 days, I've been listening to Chuck, and I felt like I was watching a public broadcast special where all the old groups come and sing, and you're supposed to support them somehow by buying their albums. I don't know. I'm sorry, Chuck. But the other thing, I did run a radio station in New York City because I got involved in radio and television when I was in the United States Air Force. Back in the 60s, went out of the Air Force, went to Florida State University, and became a disc jockey there in Tallahassee, Florida. And so some of those sounds, not necessarily the songs that Chuck's been singing, some of the sounds were prevalent at that time when I was a disc jockey. Well, what an interesting time for us to be here. Always on Tuesday evening, I'm excited not only for the privilege and opportunity to be able to share with you some of the activities that are happening in this world that seem to give us indication that what God's Word says, that prophetic scenario laid out in the prophetic passages, are about to come to pass. But in addition to that, I look forward to the time of being able to hear the other men and then to interact with each and every one of you with the Q&A that follows afterwards. So this is no exception tonight. I'm really thrilled to be able to be here with you. I was excited about last night. I'm not sure if, you know, that Ed Heinsohn is going to be, as old as he is going to be able to continue on doing all that he does forever. But it was good that in his old age, where is Ed? In his old age, he was able to come and somebody propped him up there on the platform. And he was able to deliver a pretty powerful message. I liked his approach. I liked especially some of the things he had to say as it relates to what's bad and what's good. The bad things, when he started talking about the immorality that is running rampant, and he mentioned that things, those things that were happening in our world, but I believe he should have also mentioned the things that are happening in the church and some of the activities that are unfolding in what they call Christian activity of some type that may be just about as bad as some of the things happening in the world, with the idea that they are putting in place a sodomites, I don't use the word homosexual, I use the biblical word, putting in place sodomites to lead in the church. I wish that indeed he would have expounded a bit more on some of that. And I was really excited to hear him talk about Rob Bell and the heresy that he has been perpetrating upon the world. I don't know if any of you saw the Bill O'Reilly program on Fox News a couple of weeks back when Franklin Graham was on there, and he was interviewing Franklin. And, you know, I don't agree every time with everything Franklin does, but he is always on the spot, in your face with the gospel every single time he appears, no matter where he is. But I enjoyed hearing him respond to Bill O'Reilly's question about Rob Bell's book, Love Wins, and the heresy about no eternal hell. And he asked him, he said, Franklin, what do you think about that? Well, Franklin answered the question by saying, first of all, the book is heresy, and he is a heretic. Now, I like old Franklin, right? Bottom line, right there, you know? I did enjoy that very, very much, and I was exciting to hear him make that statement. Of course, he has taken on the Islamic world as well, and I just believe he's probably pretty much in our camp, and I'm looking forward sometime. I have opportunity to preach at his home church there in Boone, North Carolina. He's always been out of town when I was there, but one of these days I hope to be able to spend a few moments with him. Never have met him. Look forward to being able to do that in the future. But indeed, that's exactly what Rob Bell is propagating. And so many others are doing the exact same thing. What really concerns me, though, about Rob Bell is who his mentor was. I looked up on Wikipedia today about Rob Bell. I wanted to get his background, a graduate of Wheaton College, and then went to Fuller Seminary, and then was invited by Eddie Dobson to come to Grand Rapids, Michigan, to the Calvary Church. And Eddie Dobson mentored him. Rob Bell was his associate pastor, took the Saturday night services until it got so big he decided to start Mars Hill. Eddie Dobson was a very good friend of Ed Heinzen. They were partners in the early days there at Liberty. Eddie Dobson was a graduate of Bob Jones University. He was the dean of students there, and I believe, I understand, heir apparent to take over for Jerry when he should leave the scene. Of course, he decided instead to go to Calvary. And really what is concerning me, and I think what we should be looking at, is some of, not what's going on in the Middle East, because I'm going to respectfully disagree with Ed that the Middle East is the bad news. In my opinion, the Middle East and what's happening there today is the good news, because it's quickly moving into confirmation of the prophetic passages found in God's Word for the end times. I don't want to see that reversed. I'm eager to see it continue and intensify. And so I don't think that's necessarily bad news. But I think there is a lot of bad news out there that needs to be dealt with. The emergent church would be one area that we need to be looking at. And many of the other things that I've already talked about that Ed talked about last night. And some of the people, I know that one of the elders at Eddie Dobson's church was a member of this organization, Pre-Trib, and has simply moved away and has written a complimentary blog on Rob Bell's book, Love Wins. And that's concerning me. I think that's the bad news. I think the body of Christ is quickly, at rapid speed, moving away from what the Word of God has to say. You know, we've been talking, and some have been bragging about the fact that we're making an impact on this world. I'm not sure. I traveled across the country and around the world, 10 foreign countries last year in 47 of the 50 states, not bragging, simply making a statement. And boy, as I travel, I see that there are less and less churches wanting to teach Bible prophecy. In fact, changing their eschatological statement in their statement of faith and wanting it to be nebulous because they say it's too controversial. I want to tell you, I stood in October at the place where they crucified a man and buried him, and 3 days later he rose up out of that grave alive and is living today and is in the heavenlies getting ready to come back. Well, you know, that's pretty controversial as well. And I'm really concerned about nobody teaching Bible prophecy. What about the big churches, the mega churches? I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand, but how many of you have been in a mega church lately to preach and teach? Well, maybe Tim LaHaye, because he wrote a bestseller, and everybody wants to get next to a bestseller and all the money he made, and so they might have him over to their church. But I don't know guys who are really teaching. I mean, Tim is teaching the Word, but guys who are really taking a stand are getting in some of these mega churches. And it's just less and less a opportunity for the Word to be taught, and people are moving away from it. So I appreciate what Ed Heinzen had to say. By the way, we've been longtime friends. We met in the middle 70s, and we were both on an airplane flying into Lynchburg, Virginia, where we're going into one of those super youth rallies that they had down there. And we got to know each other, and then we've been following each other, partnering together in ministry. So I sure appreciate Ed and teasing about being the old man. I think he's a little bit younger than I am, but he's been closer to the doors of heaven than I have. And he knows exactly how that's going to be. And we praise the Lord he has been raised up. Well, I say that's the bad news, and the good news is Israel and the Middle East and all that we've been talking about, the activities that are unfolding there. And so I thought I would take just a few moments to try to update you with some information. You may be on top of this. You may not have been. You may need to be reminded of it again. So let me do that. First of all, I want to look at Iran. Iran is the number one threat to the Israeli government and the body politic of Israel. Prime Minister Netanyahu told me personally himself when we had an opportunity to interview him for the John Ankerberg program that there are two red lines that he is going to have to deal with Iran if they come past that point. The first one was if Russia was to deliver those S-300s, that indeed they would have to deal with Iran. Now, an S-300 is a missile. It's a ground-to-air missile. It's an anti-aircraft missile. It would shut down the airspace over Iran if indeed they had those, were able to put them in position. And so he said that would be one red line. The other red line was going to be when his intelligence community said that there is a viable, absolute understanding that there is a weapon of mass destruction that can be put on as a warhead to one of those Shahab 3 missiles and reach any target in Israel itself. And he said when he knew that was the case, he was going to have to go in. Now, he's not quite as much concerned about the Shahab missile, about the S-300s now, because they have were able to receive some nuclear submarines from Germany. They're able to put those in the Persian Gulf and be able to carry out an attack, a preemptive attack on Israel without possibly having the F-16s to go in there. They have been doing naval exercises. The Israelis have. They have been doing air exercises. They are prepared. There's a lot of conversation going on. I don't know if you've been watching the batter going on between the politicos in Israel. A lot have been talking about the possibility of a preemptive strike. Should they do it? At what time should they do it? It's interesting to note that Avigdor Lieberman, he is the foreign minister for the state of Israel. If you remember, the top three positions in the Israeli government would be prime minister, foreign minister, and then the defense minister. And Avigdor Lieberman is the foreign minister. Ehud Barak is the defense minister, and of course, Prime Minister Netanyahu. Netanyahu and Barak have been on the same page as it relates to going in and doing a preemptive strike on Iran for a long time now. Avigdor Lieberman was holding back, and just last week he decided he was going to get in line with the prime minister and the defense minister. The former chief of military intelligence, you have the Mossad in Israel, military intelligence, two different agencies collaborating together, but the general who was the former chief of military intelligence made a statement that there is enough material right now, and he said this on Thursday, is enough material in Iran to develop 4 or 5 nuclear weapons of mass destruction. The present chief of staff of the Israeli Defense Force made the statement that we have 1 year to deal with this situation. What's so interesting to me today, and on my homepage of my website, prophecytoday.com, I have the article from the American Enterprise Institute. That's a conservative think tank, and the American Enterprise Institute, AEI, has said, and they have a report that's going to be released. They're going to give it to the government. I'm not sure if they were commissioned by the government or not to deal with it, but they say that indeed in 1 year there is going to be a nuclear weapon of mass destruction within the hands of the Ayatollahs and President Ahmadinejad in Iran. Now, this is not some Israeli think tank. This is a conservative think tank in Washington, D.C. And so that report is out indicating there's about 1 year. With all the talk going on about a preemptive strike against Iran, the Ayatollah has moved everything into position to be prepared for war. Today, on the front page of the London Telegraph, a newspaper out of Great Britain, was an article that the Ayatollah has made a statement, we have prepared for a preemptive strike by Israel, the United States, or whoever may decide to try to come in and take our country out. They have moved their Shahab missiles, the Shahab 3, which is the long-range missile, long enough to hit any place in the Middle East at this point in time, and in particular Israel. They have moved them to secret locations. In addition to that, they have taken their Air Force and broken them up into small units, quick response units if the country is attacked. The Revolutionary Guard has been prepared for going into Tel Aviv. And in fact, the Ayatollah said that we will fight in the streets of Tel Aviv if there is a preemptive strike that is attack on us. We'll have to deal with that. They've said, the Ayatollah this last week said, we'll put 150,000 missiles to every target all across Israel. They have dispatched, the Revolutionary Guard has dispatched 30,000 men in the Revolutionary Guard who have volunteered to be suicide bombers. They're going to come in through Syria into the Golan Heights and then spread out across Israel with the purpose of taking out the body politic of Israel. And so the Iranians are prepared. They're ready to deal with whatever may happen. There is no absolute evidence. If anybody tells you that indeed Israel is going to make a preemptive strike for sure and they give a date, you can know they're lying and lie about other things as well. Howbeit, there has been conversation that the Israeli government may give us a Christmas surprise. And that's the way they normally operate. They pick a time least expected to do something like attacking with a preemptive attack on the Iranian nuclear development program. And it's been suggested they might use Christmas Day to do that attack. But everything seems to be indicative of the fact that something is about to happen as it relates to Iran. Iran is the number one threat. There is no greater external threat for the Israeli people, according to the leadership of Israel, than Iran. And, of course, with the radical rhetoric of Ahmadinejad, we're going to wipe you off the face of the earth, continually coming, being spouted from his mouth at every opportunity he has, the Israelis have to be very aware of what's taking place and what could happen at any moment. It's an interesting, I was watching an interview on CNN last night. I'm not sure if you saw that. Her name is, she's new to CNN, Erin Burnett, I think, and front page or up front or something like that. She was in Dubai. And she was interviewing the sheikh, the Islamic leader of the area of Dubai. And he made a statement I thought very interesting. He said, if Iran ventures out and attacks Israel, Israel will wipe Iran off the face of the earth within 24 hours. Very interesting. Now, they turned the rhetoric the other direction. But I'm not sure if he was trying to send a signal to Ahmadinejad. He's right there on the coast of the Persian Gulf, and he is in a pretty precarious situation if he's going to be going after the Ayatollahs and President Ahmadinejad. But everything, as far as Iran is concerned, is looking as if it's ready to happen. Many people ask me, you probably get the same question as you're traveling and speaking across the country, will the Iranians have to face a preemptive attack against Israel? Will Israel do a preemptive attack to shut down their nuclear capabilities of trying to destroy the Jewish people? Again, Prime Minister Netanyahu said, never again are we going to allow anybody to put us in a position where we can be wiped off the face of the earth. We're not going to allow it to happen if the United States goes with us. And I don't know if you heard this either. This afternoon, there was a vote in the United States Senate, 100-0, to cut off cut off any relationship with any of the banking systems in Iran. That passed the United States Senate 100-0. and the president stepped up and asked the senators to reject that. Go back and vote on it again. Soften it up a little bit. So, you know, with these things happening, Israel is going to go one way or the other. They don't have to have the United States. They would like to have the United States. They would like to have the European Union. Catherine Ashton, who is the chief of foreign policy for the European Union, and making similar statements. The only one that's really anywhere going and trying to tell Iran they better straighten up or it's going to be bad for them is President Sarkozy of France. And he last month made the statement, I think we're going to have to attack and deal with the Iranians before they get this nuclear weapon of mass destruction. But at the same time, Saudi Arabia is very much concerned about what's going on. They fear the fact that there could be a nuclear-powered, I'm talking about nuclear weapon-powered Iran. They have suggested they are going to purchase a nuclear weapons program themselves, and the nuclear race is going to expand now with the Saudis. They have the money. They can go to Pakistan. Pakistan is the only Islamic nation with a weapon of mass destruction, a nuclear weapon, and they could purchase it, set it up there in Saudi Arabia. The reports I'm getting from some of the sources we have in Israel is that Saudi Arabia would look the other way and possibly allow the Israeli Air Force to fly across their airspace. I don't know if you understand this or not, but with the U.S. troops pulling out of Iraq this month, in fact, within days, their airspace is going to be open as well for the Israelis to go across them. They're making moves right now to try to take control of their own airspace, but all of these things are unfolding. And so I believe probably the number one story, and I don't think it's bad news, I think it's good news, because Ezekiel chapter 38, verse 5 talks about it. Persia there in Ezekiel 38, 5 was the name until 1936 of three nations today, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iran. And I think that we see on the horizon these peoples getting ready to do what the Bible says will happen. And again, it's very exciting for me to see this all unfolding. Second thing I want to bring to your attention would be the Egyptian elections. Now, just let me remind you, when Hosni Mubarak was taken down after 32 years of being the leader of the Egyptian nation, the nation of Egypt, and I'm not condoning what Hosni Mubarak might have done. That's not my point here. But when he was taken down with the help of the impact that the United States gave to the opposition there in Egypt, the Israeli government was very much concerned. President Shimon Peres, who is normally somewhat of, he's not a hawk. He is somewhat, you know, pacifist, is best I can even describe him. He said that this is the most dangerous thing that's happened in our region in the world in many years. Hosni Mubarak kept peace in the Middle East. There was never a full-fledged Middle Eastern war during the 30 years that Hosni Mubarak was in power. And so Shimon Peres, the president of Israel, who has a somewhat of a figurative job, a figurehead position, he made the statement, our best friend has been taken down. And then Prime Minister Netanyahu made a similar statement. All of this happening when Facebook and Twitter were being used by the Muslim Brotherhood to contact all of their people that indeed we're going to go to war with the Zionist nation and this peace treaty is going to be completely destroyed. Well, he was taken down, and the manipulation by all of the leadership of Egypt put him in a position to have an election. The parliamentary election started last week. They had the first 2 days of election or voting at the polls. They had it this week, and they have two more to come. And this election for the parliament there in Egypt is a 6-week endeavor, and they continue to refine those who have been elected to take charge. The Muslim Brotherhood came out best in the election with 37% of the total vote that was cast. But what's even more concerning than that, the Salafis came out with 25%. And they are more radical than the Muslim Brotherhood ever thought about being. They're in collaboration with the Wahhabis there in Saudi Arabia. So you have 62% of those elected members of the Parliament of Egypt are Islamic fundamentalists. And they are working towards putting in place an Islamic Republic similar to that of Iran, and even going farther beyond that. A good friend of mine in Israel is a young Jewish man named Itamar Marcus. He heads up a team of Jewish people who have come from out of the diaspora, from the different Arab countries. Their mother's tongue would be the Arabic language. Now, they've learned Hebrew because that's the language of the state of Israel. But these people know the languages, and Itamar Marcus heads up an organization called Palestinian Media Watch. Its web address is PALWATCH, P-A-L-W-A-T-C-H, PALWATCH.org. I would suggest this is an Orthodox Jewish man who lives in the settlements. He is articulate. He has spoken before the legislative body in Great Britain, in the European Union, in Washington, D.C. He has just been traveling in the United States in all of the major colleges addressing the issue of Israel, etc. Itamar Marcus has done a translation of a book on the Muslim Brotherhood and explains who really the Muslim Brotherhood are. You must remember the Muslim Brotherhood fostered or birthed Yasser Arafat. In the early 30s, Yasser Arafat was a student of the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood. They were established in the late 20s as one of the radical fundamentalist Islamic terror organizations. Coming out of that group also would have been Sheikh Yassin. He was the blind sheikh who established Hamas there in the Gaza Strip. And then also al-Sawari. He was the one who led the team to kill Anwar Sadat after he had visited Israel and signed a peace treaty with the Jewish state. But he was also the number two man in al-Qaeda, and with the taking out of Osama bin Laden, he became the number one man. And so these are the types of products that the Muslim Brotherhood is producing. They are going to come to power. They're going to be the major players. It's been a military control right now in this temporary government that's set up in Egypt. But the Muslim Brotherhood is going to take that over very quickly. And they're going to be a radical element at the southern border of the state of Israel. By the way, there's an interesting passage over in the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 11. I disagree with Dr. Pentecost in his commentary on Daniel chapter 11. I agree more with Rennie Showers of Friends of Israel, who has written a commentary on it as well. And when you look at Daniel 11, verses 40 to 43, you see in verse 40, the king of the north and the king of the south. I believe early on in chapter 11, starting in verses 5 through 20, you define the king of the north logistically, or where their location geographically is modern-day Syria. And the king of the south would be the location, the real estate for modern-day Egypt. And they're the first two. You see, you can't do Ezekiel 38 without bringing alongside the parallel passage of Daniel 11, verses 40 to 45, and I believe Psalm 83, because this is the entire list of the coalition of nations that will come against the state of Israel. And when you look at Daniel 11, the first two nations to make a move in that alignment of nations coming against Israel, as we often talk about, it being that of the Ezekiel Gog-Magog battle, Daniel 11 says Syria and Egypt will make the first moves. Syria and Egypt. What about Syria? Bashar Assad fighting for his existence. You know, he comes out of a background. In 1982, his father, Hafez al-Assad, went into Hama, where all the fighting is going on, where the opposition is headquartered. He killed 10,000 Syrians. And then they took bulldozers and just shoved them in the ground and started building buildings on top of the dead bodies. And so that's the background Bashar Assad comes out of. And he has continually gone after this opposition. Over 4,000 people in the opposition have been killed. Now, I don't know exactly who the opposition is. I think we need to be concerned. But it is interesting to note that President Obama has not said one thing about Bashar Assad in an effort to try to take him out of office, as he did with Hosni Mubarak. And I don't understand what's going on as it relates to that. But Bashar Assad is a mean man. He's concerned about NATO doing an attack like they did on Libya. And so the other day he said, if NATO attacks us, we will move into the Golan Heights and attack Tel Aviv. We will take back the Golan Heights. Well, the rest of the world is against Bashar Assad. Even the Arab League is against Bashar Assad. But it seems like Vladimir Putin is not. Because this week he delivered S-300, ground-to-air anti-aircraft missiles. And he made the announcement that the Russian Navy, with aircraft carriers, warships, will dock in Syria in March of 2012. So if indeed Syria is the first one to make the move and it's the Battle of Gog and Magog, Russia is lining up, getting into position to help along that line. I believe this is all going to happen, of course, when there is peace. Ezekiel 38, verse 8 says, when the Jewish people are dwelling safely in the land, they're not dwelling safely in the land. Chapter 38, verse 11, you know this as well as I do, talks about a unwalled village. That's a military terminology. Ezekiel didn't know anything about F-16, Mark for tanks, Apache helicopters. He only knew that the Jewish people protected themselves with a wall around the city. And so he said, when they let those walls down, then when will that happen? When the Antichrist appears, confirms that peace treaty, Daniel 9:27. And boy, that's on the horizon. That word there, confirm, doesn't mean sign. It means confirm. And there's three peace treaties already on the table. And everything is ready for that to be confirmed. The quartet's been in there. Tony Blair's been very active trying to bring a coexistence between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and I'm not even going to take the time to talk about that situation, but that's as hot as a firecracker as well. What I've just mentioned to you, in essence, is what I've discerned from the book of Ezekiel, gives the four major trends that will lead up to the second coming of Jesus Christ. Now, these are things that will happen, major trends. Basically, after the rapture, they could begin before the rapture and lead up to the second coming of Jesus Christ. The first one is Aliyah, and that's the Hebrew word for immigration today. Jews, it literally means going up to Jerusalem, but Jews making their way into Israel, and we know that's the case. Tommy mentioned it a few moments ago. The second one, oh, by the way, that would be Ezekiel chapter 37, but in addition to chapter 37, chapter 34. Notice chapter 34 sometime in Ezekiel, 18 times, the Lord says, I will do something. He said, I will find my people wherever they've been scattered. I will bring them into the land I promised to give them. I will feed them like a good shepherd feeds his flock. I will, I will, I will. If he says it one time, I believe it. He says it 18 times, we better be paying attention. Chapter 36 talks 35 times about the land, which is going to be 10 times what they have today in the millennial kingdom. But he says, I'm going to do this not because these people are Jewish, chapter 36, verse 22, because of my holy name's sake. I'm going to have to do this. And so they're in the land. Chapter 38 and 39, of course, the alignment of the nations, we've talked about that, giving you some information along that line. Chapters 40 to 46, 202 verses, detailed information about a temple. After the return of Christ, Zechariah 6:12, the Messiah, the branch of, builds the temple. He rules and reigns from that temple. And the details, and by the way, Randy's going to be speaking tonight. He has just completed a brand new book entitled Rose Guide to the Temple. I was looking at the PDF today. It is fantastic. I would just recommend you try to find out how you can get a copy of it. He's talking about all the temples, from the from the Garden of Eden through the Tabernacle, etc. But it's an excellent book. And he deals with the Ezekiel 40 to 46, 202 verses, detailed information about a coming temple. Dare we forget, Daniel 9:27 says there will be a temple in the tribulation period. Jesus confirmed that, Matthew 24:15. When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel, flee for the wilderness. 2 Thessalonians 2:4, and the Antichrist will walk into the Holy of Holies and claim to be God. Exactly what Isaiah 14, God's, when Satan rebelled, he heard Lucifer say, I will be worshipped in Jerusalem. And of course, Revelation 11, 1, the temple will be there. In light of that tribulation temple, 20 years ago, I did a documentary entitled Ready to Rebuild. Randy and Tommy wrote a book, Ready to Rebuild. they allowed me, I didn't steal it, I got permission, they allowed me to entitle my video, Ready to Rebuild. I had to pay them off, I put them both on the video. And we were able to produce this documentary 20 years ago. We've sold somewhere over 100,000 of them over these last 20 years. It's been amazing to see the interest in it. Well, just recently we decided we have to update it. And so our son, you know, his mother and I did the documentary 20 years ago, Ready to Rebuild. Along comes your children and they think that they can outdo you. And I know they can. That's what's exciting to me. But our son, Jim. Jim, are you in here right now, buddy? Stand up. Wave your hand wherever you are. There he is, right there in the back. He worked long with the Day of Discovery television production team. He's worked long with the John Ankerberg production team. And he's just produced his video entitled Ready to Rebuild, Revisited. And he takes some of the documentation we had from 20 years ago, integrates it into his new stuff. And I don't know if there was any pressure on him or not, but he did the production, and he asked his dad to do the teaching. So, glory to God, I was able to do the teaching, and we were able to get up onto the Temple Mount with a commercial camera. I don't know how in the world we did it. We went over there. We weren't trying to use subterfuge. They let us go through. We got up there. I did my teaching right in front of the Dome of the Rock. And all over the Temple Mount area. It is unbelievable what the Lord allowed us to do. We have some documentation on this DVD that shows the latest information. The president of the Sanhedrin, a man named Rabbi Nachman Kahana, who has his garment, the first priestly garment ever made because he's been selected to be the high priest, hanging in his closet, ready to put on and report to the Temple Mount. We talk with the man who headed up the Temple Institute, the people involved, Yehuda Glick. He told us the importance of the Temple Institute and what they're doing. And then he made a very interesting statement about the Garden of Eden and the Temple Mount. He said they're the same. And then I got a comment from Chaim Richmond, who's the expert on the red heifer, and he confirmed that that is correct. And he said all Jewish scholarship believes that. You Christians are just the Johnny-come-latelys thinking it's over there in Iraq someplace. But Chaim Richmond also is the man I met in Canton, Mississippi, where he approved four red heifers. There's been a lot of debate as to if they're red heifers or not. We've got Chaim Richmond making the statement, we have one red heifer for sure in Israel right now, possibly four, ready to be used when they're going to rebuild the temple. We go on and on with some of these things. The title of it is Ready to Rebuild, Revisited. We have several on the table out there. If you're interested after the program, you might want to stop by and see Judy. We're going to give, it's normally $25 a piece. We're going to give a 40% discount tonight, so if you're interested, you can pick it up for $15. But I know you may not have the money. I'm going to give you something. This is Christmas season, so it's not a big book of any type, but Jim and I produced an hour-and-a-half radio broadcast, and every single personality on our DVD, Ready to Rebuild, Revisited, all of them making the exact same statements I've talked about, are on this radio broadcast. This is an hour-and-a-half CD. It's going to be at the table. You go by and you pick up one. It's absolutely free. If you'd like to have it, whether you buy or not, you can pick it up. And you'll have then the documentation of what these men have to say. Don't have to listen to me. You can hear them. And this one final little note. I want to thank Mark Bailey for doing the devotional this morning, because he really set me up nicely. Last year, I came in and we were getting ready to come into the banquet, and old Mark walked up behind me and hit me in the back. He said, "Hey, DeYoung, you're a dog." I said, "What are you talking about, man?" He said, "I just, the other day, was reading the scriptures in Micah, and I found out about a place called Migdol Adar." So he said, "I thought I would Google it and see if anybody else had done anything. And when I Googled it, I saw your video at Migdol Adar." So I just happened to have in the car a production on that from what we did on Day of Discovery, Migdal Adar. We reenact on this DVD, Bethlehem Beyond the Christmas Story, the wrapping of the lamb, as he was talking about this morning in the swaddling clothes. We had a two-day, we couldn't get a brand newborn lamb, a two-day-old lamb, and a shepherd wrapped it. Then I step onto the set and I teach. We go to the location where Migdal Adar is, and I just got to give this endorsement, and then I'll sit down. My endorsement comes from my granddaughter, Abby. Jim and his two daughters and his dear wife came down to visit us. I was in Scurry, Texas over the weekend. And they, after the service on Sunday, had to go back to San Antonio where they lived. Well, Jim picked up one of these Bethlehem things. And I've been telling everybody it's great to get something great for your grandbabies. And on the way back, she was watching it. And Jimmy said that she never took her eyes off of the lamb being wrapped. What a unique way to teach our children. Anyway, this is all a part of letting me just give you a little bit of a spiel about some of the materials. I mean, you know, Ed Heinzen went for 15 minutes on his stuff last night. So if he can do it, I guess I can take at least a minute and a half. And if indeed there's anything out there that we could assist you with, we'd love to do it. Our website is prophecytoday.com. We update it on a daily basis with all the information I've been talking about. Many of the things that I said are available are right there. Thank you so very much for coming, for participating for these last 20 years. Tommy, thank you, buddy, for being the executive director and making this happen. And though I'm not a Hal Lindsey, I'm sure glad I'm here on Tuesday night to speak. God bless Amen. You. Keep looking up. Jesus is coming.
Thank you. Here is Bill Koenig, who is a White House correspondent, one of the few Christians there that covers all of that. And Bill works really hard to follow what's happening in the White House and also in the Middle East as well. He's made a number of trips to Israel each year and is very much up on the national scene. So he's going to come at this time and tell us about how people can get on your email list and everything.
Thank you, Tommy. I appreciate it. Great to be with you all. This has probably been one of the most incredibly challenging PowerPoints I've ever put together. I can't imagine how many complications I've had today. But anyhow, it's finished. So first of all, our website, for those not familiar, this is our website address, watch.org. We post news 365 days out of the year on world news that's biblically relevant. And things are happening so fast, it is very difficult to stay up with everything. You know, usually you have two or three or four major events taking place at any one time. And it's, for the most part, if you're trained, it's relatively easy to stay up with it. But you still, it requires a lot of time. But the challenge today is all final day events are in play. The 10 or 12 major events, Iran, Russia, Syria, one world financial order, one world political order, interfaith movement, and most important is the time clock, the nation of Israel, God's time clock. So it's incredibly challenging. Each one of these issues are more complicated than normal. They're more fluid than normal. They're moving faster than normal. Plus, they're interrelated. And I have numerous friends, as well as friends here at the conference. We stay in touch with each other. And I think we're all in just absolute awe in how fast things are unraveling in the Middle East. And I've been watching this for 16 years, and I've never seen anything quite like this. But we're blessed to have the Internet because we have the opportunity to monitor the major news organizations from around the world, along with stay in touch with our contacts that we have on the ground throughout Europe, in the Middle East, in Israel, and also here in the United States. So as I say frequently now, we're blessed to be living in the most exciting time in biblical history, and we're also blessed to be that tiny, tiny little part of the church that understands the biblical significance of the time and the fact that Genesis to Revelation is playing out as written, the inerrant Word of God. This is a picture of our website. Daily postings, as I mentioned. This is what goes out every Friday by email. This is a summary of what I have in my news report that week. It's usually about 14, 15 pages each week of what happened that week that was biblically relevant with commentary. And it does a really good job of keeping people up to date on what's going on. It's a subscription-based. It's $1 a week, 6-month subscription or 12-month subscription. This is my book that I've had out for quite a few years, and it's still selling extremely well. It focuses on the consequences of what happens when the United States or even the international community, when they apply pressure to Israel, the major catastrophic events that take place. I also document what's happened to every Middle East leader that's attempted to conquer or divide the land of Israel. And I can tell you, for these really bold guys like Erdogan and Ahmadinejad and Nasrallah and Assad, and even to a lesser extent Mubarak, they're not going to have a pretty ending, based on about 8 previous Middle East leaders over the last 30, 40 years that have attempted to divide that land. There's been a lot of catastrophic deaths, there's been untimely deaths, and these are consequences. And these Middle East leaders will be dealt with in a very unique way. I've presented the book to over 100 of our leaders now, with the Obama administration, the vice president, top White House staff, senators and congressmen, top media members, top think tank officials, Christian leaders. And in the last couple of weeks, I had a chance to meet and talk to Gilad Sharon, Ariel Sharon's son, at a bookstore in North Washington, D.C. Gilad is the one that came up with the disengagement plan, supposedly, for his father. He's also written a book about his father. It's a very large book. Gilad is a very nice guy. But I had the chance to give him a book, my book, and there's one chapter in there that talks about the parallels between Rabin and his father's political endings. It was very respectful, but I showed some very interesting parallels between both of their political endings. And also Prince Turki Al-Faisal. This is a member of the royal family. He spoke at the U.S. Islamic Conference a couple weeks ago in Washington, D.C., and some people believe he'll very likely be the next foreign minister to Israel when the other Al-Faisal, who has a serious case of Parkinson's disease, moves on. Turki Al-Faisal is expected to be, or more than likely going to be, the next foreign minister. And I had a chance to give him my book, and I told him he really needs to get familiar with Saudi Arabia. Yeah, sorry, Saudi Arabia. And then AIPAC. I'm going to run through a couple little events that were very significant this year, and I think all of us were in awe of Barack Obama's statement on May 19th, Thursday, May 19th, and then Sunday, Friday to the 19th, that Israel needs to go back to the 6-day borders. There was no discussion about security, which the UN Resolution 242 discusses. And then I was at this event. This is AIPAC. AIPAC's the largest Jewish lobby group in the United States, and they've done an extraordinarily good job. And they have 100,000 members. They had 10,000 members at the Washington Convention Center, and they had Obama come and speak, and this is what he said. The borders of Israel and Palestine should be based on the 67 lines with mutually agreed swaps, so that secure and recognized borders are established for both states. As for security, every state has a right to self-defense, and Israel must be able to defend itself by itself against any threats, he stressed. So the way he kind of said this is, we're going to do some swaps to help Israel feel secure, but also there's some very large settlement communities in this land that he's talking about. But he's talking about the 6-day borders. He's talking about land swaps. The Palestinians said, no such thing. We want it all. We want it all the way back to the 6-day borders. That's the kind of deal we're looking for. But nonetheless, within a few hours of this major, bold address to American Jews, we had another catastrophic weather-related event happen in Joplin, Missouri. And this wasn't days or weeks or months later. It was immediately after Obama's address on Sunday. Within a few hours, he was on the way to Europe. He spoke at AIPAC, and he was monitoring this major storm that hit Joplin, Missouri. Again, we've had over 80 all-time U.S. record catastrophes that happened at the same time or within 24 hours of U.S. pressure on Israel to divide their land. And then a couple days later, under pressure from the White House, even though Prime Minister Netanyahu handled himself extremely well, Netanyahu stated for the first time he acknowledged that some settlements would end up being outside Israel's borders in any peace deal and hit it as a softening in the line in Jerusalem and during a landmark speech to Congress. He also mentioned that he was the sixth prime minister of Israel that favored a Palestinian state. The only reason Israel's prime ministers have ever wanted a Palestinian state is because of pressure from the United States. Within a few hours of his address to Congress, we had another major wave of tornadoes and massive storms, incredibly high winds that hit this area, the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and into Oklahoma, and it was in a major record-setting waves of events. So far, the United States this year has had $14 billion events. This is a record. Joplin was the largest spring storm and most expensive spring storm in history. We also have, Obama has signed more federal disaster orders in his 3 years in office, just under 3 years in office, than any other president in 4 years. And it's just a wave of one event after another after another. And when that land of Israel is touched, and I said this many times here and many other places before, there's an atmospheric reaction and a political reaction, and sometimes both. And right now, the leaders of the nations of the world are on a collision course with the God of Israel. And this is an atmospheric reaction. And there, you don't touch Judea and Samaria. You don't divide Jerusalem. And I was thinking this week, you know, Israel's only on maybe 24-25% of the covenant land that they were promised through the Abrahamic covenant in Genesis 15, 17, and 18. When you think about it, but the focus right now of the world is on Judea and Samaria. Not any other of that land. And that's the biblical heart. That's the heart of Israel. That's the heart of the promised land. That's the heart of the Holy Land. And the city of Jerusalem, we all know about Israel's history with that city. Don't touch the land. Don't touch it. But we also know there will eventually, according to Joel 3:2, there will eventually be major consequences. And also Zechariah 12 through 14 also talks about enormous consequences. When the nations will attempt, Zechariah 12:3 talks about Jerusalem becoming that burdensome stone. Zechariah 12:9, when the nations, the military, will come against Israel and be defeated. I'm going to go through a couple things. I'm going to fill in a few things that Jimmy didn't mention today. He covered a lot of really important things. I'm going to add a couple things, and then I'm going to go into some other areas of the Middle East, because the biggest play and one of the most important things facing our country in the next 12 months, up to the presidential election in 2012, is what is happening in the Middle East. The area is on fire. Economic boom in Israel. Economy 3-4% continually doing well. Great central banker in Stanley Fisher. Israel's really blessed to have him as their lead banker. 120 trillion cubic feet of gas in the Levithian field, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. 250 billion barrels of oil, they think, is now in the Negev, which would be at the equivalent of what Saudi Arabia has. As far as the natural gas, Russia sent their top natural gas experts into Israel and told them they would like to develop the Russian natural gas oil fields. And they also talked about bringing a pipeline from Ashkelon to Eilat and into some of their very large customers in other parts of Asia and other parts of the world. And also Russia is concerned about the fact that Israel is going to be an exporter of natural gas soon. And they're going to send oil to Western Europe. And Europe is not going to have to rely just on Russian oil and natural gas. But what's interesting is Israel say, well, we'll consider it. And right after they left Israel, they went to Lebanon, they went to Turkey. And now Israel's navy is being built up in preparation for a conflict that they believe that they're going to have with Turkey over that Mediterranean natural gas. The political left and right, this is one of the most disturbing things, and I'm sure Jimmy sees this all the time and has to bite his tongue when he sees what happens with the political left in Israel. They are an enemy of Israel. The fact that the political left influences the Haaretz and other newspapers in Israel to the extent that they are blasting Netanyahu for not doing a deal. They believe giving up Judea and Samaria and East Jerusalem is going to bring them peace. How could they be so foolish? Look at country after country through the Middle East. It's Arab against Arab, Sunni versus Shia, tribal faction against tribal faction. And the Israeli, Zippy Livni was in Washington last week with Hillary Clinton at the Saban Forum, blasting the Netanyahu government. And she does it every chance she has. And some of these writers with Haaretz, they have to be blind to reality. If they give up this land, Israel gives up this land, there will be no more Israel. It's crazy. But they have a lot of influence in the nation of Israel. The secular versus religious, very much the same issue here. The political left in Israel, secular. And the right tends to be religious and also extremely conservative. And also they can see things very clearly, kind of like here in the United States. Sometimes the conservatives see things so clearly, but the liberals and secular do not. The border concerns, obviously, Israel was content when Mubarak was in leadership, because they had relatively quiet borders, they were for the most part content with Assad despite the differences because the borders were quiet, and they've been comfortable with King Abdullah of Jordan because the borders were quiet. And thanks to Mr. Obama, Mubarak was forced out. You have a very disruptive situation in Egypt, and I'll touch on that here in a little bit with some more details with some Coptic Christian friends of mine from Washington. And you have a situation in Syria, which is, Jimmy hit on some really key points there. And you have a situation in Jordan. They're very concerned about the Muslim Brotherhood influence in that country. Even to the extent that Jordan says they favor a Palestinian state, but they want Israel to be the buffer between their country and the future Palestinian state. Boy, that says a lot. And there continues to be an effort to delegitimize Israel. Our beloved Secretary of Defense, Panetta, our former CIA director, last week at the Saban Forum, told everybody to get back to the DAMN table, and it's time to sit down and work out a peace deal. And he also talked about Israel is continuing to be isolated, and he's very concerned about that, so that's why they need to get back to the table. This is our defense secretary, who's extremely concerned about Israel hitting Iran first. And that's why he's very active. He's been in Israel recently to meet with Netanyahu, to meet with Barak, and some of the other leaders. Palestinian issue, Hamas and Fatah are talking about a unity government. But they're talking about Fayyad, who's one of the most well-respected, despite his flaws, one of the most well-respected Palestinians who is involved very much in their economic development. If they have a unity government, Hamas wants Fayyad to leave. Oh, what kind of unity government's that? It's just incredibly farcical. Iran's continuing to fund Hamas. Weapons continue to be smuggled into Gaza, more in the last, since the disengagement in 2005 than the previous 30 years. And the UN statehood. I was up at the United Nations for the Palestinian effort. And what's really interesting about this is we had the world community at the UN, and one of the hot topics at the UN was a future Palestinian state. I talked to some friends of mine with the media from Europe and from Asia and some fellows from the Middle East, and they all told me that the hot news the week they came to the UN in their papers were the Palestinian issue over the land that Israel occupies. Isn't it amazing how God continues to do that? The entire world is focused still on this tiny little nation tiny little nation, the extent that it occupies and dominates the news around the world the week before this UN meetings, during the UN meetings, and a little bit thereafter. But fortunately, the United States at that time, President Obama is concerned about the Jewish vote, 2% of the population, but supposedly, I understand, maybe give as much as 25% of the money that goes to the Democratic Party. And he doesn't want to jeopardize that. So I think he's going to be careful what he does, but he's going to let Hillary Clinton do a lot of the dirty work here this next 12 months. And you'll see more of that. But we also have the final day nations quickly aligning in the Middle East. This is amazing. And unfortunately, things are not moving in a good direction. But the Muslim outreach began when Barack Obama went to this very large Muslim cemetery, seminary, cemetery. That's a good one. Islamic seminary in Cairo, Egypt, and discussed how Thomas Jefferson loved the Quran to the extent that he had a copy of the Quran in the White House library. Thomas Jefferson had a copy of the Quran in the library so he could figure out, who are these Barbary pirates? Who are these people? I want to know what makes these people tick. He didn't have it to honor the Quran, but here we have the President of the United States, the most influential political leader in the world, telling the world that our beloved Thomas Jefferson honored the Quran and John Adams. It's incredible. And that's at the time he threw the doors of America open to Islam. We have had a lot of material in our reports the last couple months from very credible sources that show how the Muslim Brotherhood has penetrated the Obama administration. Obama's representative to the Muslim nations, the 56 Muslim nations, has the Quran memorized. And we continue to see here how we have Muslim Brotherhood members who have moved into key positions in the Pentagon and on Capitol Hill and at the White House. This is extremely disturbing news. Extremely disturbing news. And again, Obama talks about being a Christian, but he has done more for Islam. Matter of fact, Barry Rubin from Israel said a couple of weeks ago that there will be no one that has more to do with the radicalization and the rapid movement of the Muslim Brotherhood across the Middle East than Barack Obama. The Mubarak collapse, he forced him out. And Hillary Clinton spoke of him leaving. Saudi Arabia is furious. King Abdullah is very furious. I go to a lot of think tanks in Washington, D.C., and they said our relationships with the Saudis, who have a lot of issues, but also they're a very important player in the Middle East, has never been as bad a shape as it is right now. And a lot of these guys, a lot of these think tanks I go to, even Islamic think tanks, they say that most of the leaders in the Middle East they do not trust Obama. They are fearful about riding or siding with the United States in the future. And they also perceive him as weak, and he won't deal with some of the very significant problems in the Middle East, such as Iran, such as the situation in Afghanistan. So this is very important for our country. They are responsible for the Muslim Brotherhood movement across the Middle East, and also which is helping move forward the Shiite versus Sunni conflict. I'll hit that in just a little bit. And also the pressure in Israel. Hillary Clinton is the one that from the beginning believed that all settlement construction in Israel must be stopped, including all construction in the city of Jerusalem. And as Elliot Abrams said, who worked with President Bush in the Middle East in the previous administration, said it was an absolute total mistake. Forcing Israel to do this, stopping all construction, putting pressure on Israel in Jerusalem. It was a horrible mistake. And in a lot of ways, when you look at it, it's a mistake, but in some ways it's really been beneficial to Israel because it halted the peace process fairly rapidly after all of these things failed. Israel always offers very generous packages to the Palestinians, but they don't accept them. And they never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. That's the saying there in Israel, and they've done a great job of that. But also the Iran problem continues to be a very significant one. I'll go through these countries really quick. We're watching very closely what's happening in Pakistan. According to one of the recent studies, Pakistan is the fourth most, Pakistan is one of the top most corrupt countries in the world. We have given over $5 billion in U.S. aid to the Musharraf government. Unfortunately, most of that money didn't get to its intended sources, Pakistan's military. It went to paying off a lot of people to keep Musharraf alive. It's the terror capital of the world. That's a big concern of ours. We have a lot of problems with Pakistan right now, and it's a terror capital of the world. Many terrorist camps that are training terrorists that are going to be spread to other parts of the world are going to come out of Pakistan. Al-Qaeda is a player there. Taliban is there. We have a tremendous amount of Christian persecution. There was a high official, it was a Christian that came to the State Department in Washington, D.C., told the State Department, I need cover, I'm going to be assassinated. This blasphemy law, anybody that accepts any other religion in Pakistan is a target. And this gentleman said he's going to be assassinated, and sure enough, after a couple of weeks after he got home, the highest level, one of the highest people in the Pakistani government who's Christian was assassinated. They have 120 nukes, great concern to the United States. They are helping Iran develop its nuclear missile program. We provide them $2 billion in annual aid, military aid, and personal aid. I think that's what our latest figure is, $2 billion. We've given them $5 billion plus. But I think the last figure that we're talking about right now is $2 billion. There's a lot of people in Washington who like to say, no, we don't want to give you anything and get the heck out of Pakistan, but we're real concerned about those 120 nukes. And we're also real concerned about those terror camps there. So our relationship with Pakistan right now is very, very tenuous. This recent attack, NATO attack, U.S.-NATO attack that killed military members of Pakistan has really affected our relationship there. And Pakistan's very important for our supply routes to Afghanistan, and those have been greatly impacted by this recent attack. Afghanistan, 1,682 casualties, 2,309 U.S. and NATO people injured. It's a $427 billion war. Afghanistan is the second most corrupt nation in the world. And a majority of their gross domestic product, which is in the 15 to 20 million, 20 billion range, I think that's where it is right now, is from heroin poppies, the development of poppies for heroin production. Double-minded government. They're our friends one day, they bash us the next. The Taliban, according to some of our military leaders who are very sad about moving out of parts of Afghanistan where they really believe they could be successful, are very concerned. The Taliban is moving. Right when we move out, the Taliban moves in and moves in strength and force. We have 100,000 U.S. troops there. We'll have 10,000 coming home at the end of the year. 23,000 plus will be removed next summer. The bottom line from the military circles in Washington is we are not serious about Afghanistan, so there's a lot of reluctance by anybody in Afghanistan to side with America, because once they do and we leave, they're targets, like what happened in Fallujah in Iraq. They became sitting ducks, and a lot of Iraqis that stood with us during the surge were killed. Iran, nuclear weapon development, committed. Missile technology, according to Udi Rubin, who's the father of the Arrow Missile Defense Program, who comes to Washington every year to brief us, a large group of people, said that the advancement of missile technology in Iran in the last 12 months has been very significant, especially the short-range missiles that puts Kuwait in Iraq, in United Arab Emirates, in Qatar at risk. It's a great concern of these neighboring Persian Gulf countries. 90% of the oil in the Middle East comes through the Persian Gulf. 40% of the world's oil comes through the Persian Gulf. A lot of the Washington think tanks are doing all the studies, the cause and effects of an Iranian attack on Iran's nukes. There's all kinds of extreme possibilities of what could happen. And Iran's going to filter that too. They're going to fuel that too because they want to keep from being hit. And they're going to do all kinds of their typical stuff that they say and, you know, all their rhetoric. They want a caliphate. They want to control from Iran to the Mediterranean. You all know that. They're moving into a position of great influence in Iraq. They brokered the political differences with the Al-Maliki government, who Al-Maliki is a Shiite. Al-Sadr is back from 4 years of study back into Basra. He's a major force inside of Iraq. I talked to a journalist the other day who said that there are areas near Basra where a lot of the oil is, that the language in the public square is Farsi, not Arabic. And another friend of mine with Arab News who works at the White House, her uncle was a former general in the Iraqi army, and they are petrified at the movement of Iran and are very concerned about the very clever, strategic, and patient move of Iran into some positions of key influence. Despite the dislike of Iran and Iraq, they have a lot. There's a bad blood there because of the Shiite Sunni thing. But we have to remember also, Iraq is a Shiite majority, and a lot of the Shia are really mad at Sunnis because a lot of Shiites were killed under Saddam Hussein. But you'll see where Iran is ending up, where the oil is. They're moving into the key oil area of Iraq, which is Basra. They in Saudi Arabia, there's 2 million Shia that live where a majority of Saudi Arabia's oil refineries are. There's only maybe 10, 12, 15% of all of Saudi Arabia that's Shiite, but they live around the oil. And the United States is training 35,000 Saudis right now to be able to handle that oil in protection. Israel statements are typical. Russia and China continues to stop any type of meaningful sanctions against Iran. As Joel Rosenberg would say, and he's been saying it a lot lately, and I appreciate the fact that we need to call the situation in Iran for what it is. We have an apocalyptic death cult that's attempting to do some very serious things. And I go to a lot of the think tanks, and they don't talk about the apocalyptic commitment. Occasionally they do bring it up. They use the typical Washington think tank, let's figure out how to fix this. It never gets any better. But the biggest problem, as Joel said, he's correct, is this apocalyptic. The Khomeini, the Ayatollah, the Ahmadinejads believe that they have this role to usher in the 12th Imam. And that's their motivation. And then the Revolutionary Army in Iran controls business. They control the military. They control the police. And that's why the 85% can't make any major headway inside of Iran or do a revolution, because they find the initiators and take them in the public squares and hang them or shoot them. And the 15% have a lock grip on the nation of Iran. But it's also interesting, as we're hearing a lot lately about Israel's desire to take care of some of the big problems they're having. Well, the top nuclear scientist in Iran have been assassinated, most of them. Five Russian nuclear scientists were killed in June in an aircraft crash, in a jet crash in Russia. And what was interesting is that it looked like there was no apparent error. It just happened. That's what the Russians said, that it didn't look like anything suspicious. But these were five Russian nuclear scientists that died in a jet crash in Russia that were all involved in the development of Iran's nuclear weapon program. The top drone expert was killed. The Stuxnet virus, which was supposedly, according to the New York Times, an Israeli-U.S. joint venture, was put into through a USB port or a flash drive port in Iran that got into the computer system that it infected 30,000 computers. This was an inside job. It didn't come over the internet. It went into a USB port through a flash drive and contaminated the system. Well, they've got a new virus now. It's called the Dookie. And this is a very interesting, it's a byproduct of Stuxnet, but what's interesting about this virus, it gathers data to make future computer attacks possible. It reads what the computers do so our maybe Israel and U.S. experts know how to counter that. And it also has to do with their nuclear program. And then most of you probably know a couple weeks ago, an Iranian general, one of their top generals, was killed in at a Revolutionary Guard Shihab 3 and 4 plant, a mysterious explosion. And then there was another mysterious explosion at a nuclear facility last week. New York Times had a picture of that. There wasn't much left. Israel's, I think, something's taking place already. Everybody's worried about an inside job, but I tell you, it's not a safe job to have if you're working for Iran's nuclear weapon program. But the big thing, as Uzi Rubin said, is Iran's ballistic missile advancement. The Shihab 3 and 4, supposedly this explosion will set that back a bit. I don't know how much, but they are incredibly committed. As Jimmy said, Iran might already have enough to do 3 or 4 bombs, but they need a delivery system. And that's why the missile development program is so important. Iraq, we had 4,475 troops. We had 30,500 that were injured. We had spent $804 billion. That is expected to climb to $3 trillion when you factor in the cost of treating our injured soldiers. Iraq is the fourth most corrupt country in the world. I went to a briefing in Washington by one of the Iraqi journalists, and he said, "You cannot believe the corruption in that country." There was $25 billion spent to increase the energy and electricity in Iraq. It's still incredibly bad. They have power outages at key times of the year and during the hot summers. You know, we have spent almost $1 trillion in Iraq, and we're talking about tens of billions of dollars that were stolen, sent away, put away. I mean, it's just hard for us to comprehend the kind of numbers of money that was stolen inside of Iraq by many key leaders. So the places where the United States has invested military men and women's lives and their future lives, 30,000 plus injured, and $1 trillion is the second and fourth most corrupt nations in the world. Not a good investment. We know it was a mistake, but we also understand that these are accelerating final day events. So that's the significance in terms of how it's accelerating final day events in the Middle East. U.S. troop departure, we're going to be out of there completely by the end of the year. We'll leave a few people behind. John McCain and Senator Graham and a few others were furious at Barack Obama because he made a feeble attempt to keep us in. He only talked to the Prime Minister of Iraq twice this year, and that was to discuss about us leaving. There was no negotiations. We really should keep about 10,000 troops there. Then it finally got down to 2,500 to 3,000, and Pentagon says, no way, we're not going to do that. That's putting our troops in harm's way. They're coming home. And I talked to a key general who worked in Iraq. His son's been in 5 tours of duty, in Iraq, and 3 tours of duty in Afghanistan. And he said, with the attitude, he's a retired general, told me this a couple weeks ago in New York, that we need to get out of Afghanistan as soon as possible because he says, we're not committed to that war. And if we're not committed, we need to get the heck out of there. Because we're not. And how do you fight a war? As a military member, you're in a place where you have your commander-in-chief is not committed to a war? I mean, what are you there for? So that's going to be a big issue. But I was talking to Ken Pollack the other day. He is the head of the Saban Forum at Brookings Institute. And Ken said that I was asking about the Iran, and he just got back from there. And he said he is more concerned, much more concerned about a civil war inside of Iraq between the Shiite and Sunnis, and he said that could happen at any time. It's really pretty intense there right now. And then we'll have our 47,000 troops, as I mentioned, gone by the year end. And Russia and China are going to make a lot of money in the oil business in Iraq, as well as the British and French and other oil companies. Iraq was clever in the extent that they're allowing these countries to come in and get 10 or 15% for doing the drilling. In a lot of other countries throughout the Middle East, in the past, they allowed the oil companies to joint venture with the Saudis and others. But no, this is a straight 10, 15% contract. But Russia and China are going to be in there in a big way. Saudi Arabia, very concerned about the succession of King Abdullah. Some think tank guys said another 5 to 10 things would be okay. Some people are very concerned about someone that could come in and make a run on Saudi Arabia when King Abdullah dies. He's 88 or 89, not in very good health. He was able to buy off the Arab Spring with $100 billion. The youth unemployment is astronomical. Many people are graduating from college, no jobs, no homes, no future. They made a lot of money off the oil price jump, and as Jimmy said, Saudi Arabia is petrified. They are very concerned about a nuclear Iran. Israel first, Saudi Arabia second. And that's why they are, as Jimmy mentioned, that's why there's a unique cooperation right now between Israel and Saudi Arabia pertaining to flyover rights, and even supposedly there's some weaponry on the ground in one of the major airstrips in Saudi Arabia. Shiites near the oil, I mentioned that early. I'll zip through these quick. Sudan and Libya, southern part mostly Christian, that's split. That's going to be an ongoing battle. Oil, a lot of oil in the south, which will be a benefit to southern Sudan. The Islamics who are living in the northern part. Many people believe that they'll be part of the Ezekiel 38-39 attack against Israel. Gaddafi's gone. Rebels are moving into... There's going to be a real tribal war inside of Libya. There's a lot of war for control over Libya. The Muslim Brotherhood's positions himself extremely well there. Egypt... this is going to be a very significant problem. 84 million population, half the people are literate. And I saw on CNN a couple of days ago the fact that during the election, when they had about a 65% turnout, that the illiteracy is so bad, in Egypt that they had to create symbols next to the name of the political party. Like Muslim Brotherhood, it could be a car. Are the Salafis an orange? So all these political parties had actual symbols so people knew what to pick. Pick the car, pick the orange, pick the grape. That's what happened. 40 to 42% Muslim Brotherhood. My Coptic Christian friend from Egypt, who's in a think tank, the Hudson Institute in Washington, said that he predicted that 2 months ago. The Muslim Brotherhood, about 40%. He said they'll be able to put a parliamentary faction together of about 70%, and his numbers are great. 40, 42% of Muslim Brotherhood, the Salafis, 20 to 25%, maybe as high as 30%. So those groups are committed to a constitution based on Sharia law. And my friend Samuel also said that all the political candidates in Egypt are in favor of getting rid of the Israeli-Egyptian peace deal from Camp David. So there's great concern, obviously, about the border. Even in Israel right now, they're very concerned about another terror attack coming in from the Sinai. Tourism is collapsing. They're going through their foreign cash reserves quickly. The Coptic Christians, 8 to 10 million, are persecuted. They want to get out of the country, but they can't get their visas or they can't get things handled quick enough to be able to get out. It's a very difficult time and obviously a danger to Israel. And also there's been six or seven explosions now of natural gas that goes into Israel and Jordan. But the big thing here is Samuel said... the Muslim Brotherhood, they don't want to run the country right now, but they want to take advantage of the bad shape that it is in. This is an Islamic modus operandi, and it's going to be very, very difficult. And they're going through their foreign reserves so quickly. People aren't comfortable about the future of Egypt. Erdogan from Turkey is not very popular amongst the Arab leaders in the Middle East, but he's going to play to the street just like Nasser did in 67. That's the way Arab leaders become powerful, is by playing to the street. And that's Erdogan's plan there in Turkey. Islamist in control, the relationship that Israel used to have with the Turks is no, they used to do a lot of military maneuvers together, that's over. Major generals in Turkey resigned recently. The relations strained, the flotilla incident is a mess. Israel should never apologize. Russian relations have improved, and influence in Egypt, as I mentioned. Lebanon, Hezbollah, 55,000 missiles and rockets pointed at Israel. Hariri assassination is pointing to four or five top people with Hezbollah in Syria. And they've been effectively been able to keep this final report from being presented. And that was something that Hezbollah did not want and threatened. But here, I'll finish with this because my time's running. Syria is the play right now. Everybody in the Middle East that's a player has a skin in this game. The U.S. wants Assad to be overthrown. Clinton again today, Hillary Clinton, it's almost like this is a personal thing for her to call on Assad's government to collapse and for him to step down. As Jimmy said, Assad threatened Tel Aviv. If NATO comes against Assad or the United States, the missiles are going to rain down in Tel Aviv. Russia said the same thing. We don't want you overthrowing that government. And the fact that they're moving these three ships, one of them is supposed to land on Thanksgiving weekend, but we moved our USS George Bush from the Persian Gulf and put it off the Syrian coast. So now it's going to be March where we're going to have three ships that are going to be docked at Tartus, Syria. And this is very significant. The USS George Bush right now is doing joint military maneuvers with the 6th Fleet in the Mediterranean. They had been down with the 5th Fleet along with USS Thinis. It's extremely important. So, you know, Iran needs Syria. Iran has provided $5 billion to Syria. Iran sends rockets and missiles to Hezbollah through Syria. Russia, the fact that it would even consider moving major ships down there and to make the statements they have is very serious stuff. And also, Russia doesn't perceive Barack Obama as a very strong leader, so they're going to test him, and Putin's going to be back in power right around March. And he's going to be positioned where he could stay in office for 2 6-year terms. And according to Jane's Defense Weekly, Syria has the most advanced chemical weapons in the world. And we also know that what Isaiah 17 talks about, the future of Damascus. One other thing quickly, Jordan mentioned King Abdullah is very concerned about a Palestinian state. He wants the buffer. He's concerned about the Muslim Brotherhood. And I can finish with this one. Russia, the Putin's relationship with Turkey, Iran is excellent. He has just given 27 ICBMs. I mean, these are some very serious weapons. I think they're ICBMs, but they're very significant anti-aircraft and anti-ship missiles. Now, they've committed to delivering that. I mean, right in the middle of this, he said this was a deal that was cut in 2007, but Israel said, hey, we'll help you with the drones. And then all of a sudden, right in the thick of this, Russia says, we're going to go ahead and send these very important weapons. Russia has its eyes on Israel's natural gas. They have very significant tech agreements with Israel. I really question why Israel did these a major joint venture in science and technology and agriculture. I don't know why they did that. And Netanyahu said this was a great achievement. I don't understand that. But it's very problematic. And also Russia is building three new seaports, Tartus, Syria, as I mentioned, one in Libya, another one in Yemen down toward the mouth of the Red Sea. And they continue to provide weapons to Arabs. And Putin said earlier this year that the U.S. is a parasite on global economy. That doesn't sound like an ally. So everything is aligning, and we're living in extremely exciting times, and the Word of God has the details. So we're blessed. Thank you.
Okay. If you would like to ask a question, come up to these two microphones right there, and you can ask your questions. So right now, Bill's the only one here, so if anybody has a question for Bill, we can go ahead and get started. Otherwise, I might answer the question.
I have a question.
I can make it up. Go ahead.
I missed about Jordan. That was, I think, the one country I didn't, for some reason, I missed it. What I always thought that they kind of had somewhat friendly ties, the way that they're trying to help them with their agriculture on the other side of the Jordan and things like that. Where do they stand in all this?
Israel's had really good relationships with King Hussein and King Abdullah. And matter of fact, King Hussein was really coaxed into becoming part of the group that came against Israel in the Six-Day War. They didn't want to. Really, they really were very reluctant to do that. And throughout the years, they had a decent relationship, and Israel never really worried about that border. But King Abdullah right now has about 1 million Iraqis that flooded his country after Desert Storm, especially after Iraqi freedom. So they have a huge Iraqi problem. About 65% of Jordan's Palestinians, or I like to say Arabs from Palestine. King Abdullah's wife is Palestinian. So, but they're very concerned right now about the Muslim Brotherhood movement inside of Jordan and whether he can stay in position. They've already had a government collapse. And they're going to have a new prime minister. So that's just another area that's extremely... They aren't so concerned about an attack from Jordan, but some countries could use Jordan as a launching pad or an area in which to attack Israel in a future war.
So Muslim Brotherhood has a beachhead even in Jordan?
Yes, sir. And pretty much most of the countries. 100 million people and very significant throughout the Middle East.
They're right now trying to bring down the monarchy, doing everything they possibly can to bring down King Abdullah. And so the Muslim Brotherhood is really treacherous. I'd really suggest, Itamar Marcus wrote translated an excellent book on the Muslim Brotherhood from one of their leaders themselves, and it'd be good for you to look at it. Go to my website, prophecytoday.com. It's a special report. You just click on it, and then you can get it.
This question is for Dr. Price. The drilling that you did, you showed samples of something that was pulled up. Did you do any type of analysis on that, and what was it?
No, it's not enough to do the analysis on. We can do, like, C14 on something that's about the size of your thumbnail. But I'm not sure this was from the object. It was from something that's probably surrounded it or broken off from it or something like that. And actually, to be honest, never made it down the mountain. It was collected by some of the Kurds, put in a bag, and it was transported down for us, and we never got it. So it's one of those things that disappeared. And there's a lot of strange things that happened in regard to that. But we'll have plenty of samples this next time. So. Yeah, no, it was black. It was. It's kind of hard to say. I mean, it was. It wasn't like any of the native rock. Something different. We don't know what it was.
Kind of pitch.
Could wish.
Yeah,
I wish I could have tested it. But.
Was it a curveball or a slider?
Randy?
Oh, that's funny.
If it's the Ark, what arrangements do you have with the government? What are you going to do with it? I mean,
it's not going to move from the location.
Well, I mean, what, if it turns out to be what you would like it to be, where do we go from there?
Yeah, well, look, we're limited in with even technology of getting down to it. So the best we can do is expose a small portion and take samples of that, document it, film it. As soon as we walk away from it, it all gets covered up again with ice and snow. So it's reburied within days, literally. So there's no plans that I know of. The thought in the area is that this would be very good for tourism. It could bring in parallel peace. The Armenians have a great stock in the Ark. The Kurds basically worship the ground it's on. The Turks claim it. All of this. Unfortunately, the Turks are at war with the Kurds. The Armenians hate the Turks because they deny the Armenian genocide. I mean, there's just not going to make a difference. In fact, probably it would stimulate conflict rather than stop it. So, but at least that plays well right now. Any talk of tourism to eastern Turkey gets you a lot of currency there.
Randy, over here.
Bill, I guess we can sit down.
There's been legitimate and illegitimate excavations over there. I think of astronaut Irwin. Could you give a brief synopsis of some of the hoaxes? Yeah. You see these different pictures, you know, alleged Ark pictures, and then
Sure. You mentioned. I mean, last year I did that here at the conference on one of those. You mentioned Colonel James Irwin, who was the astronaut who walked on the moon. He had an ambition to walk on Noah's Ark more than walk on the moon. And he went to four expeditions there. Dr. Dick Bright, who's the head of our expedition, was with him on all of those. When he died, his wife said that Jim wanted the mantle to pass to him. So, in a sense, we're carrying out part of his legacy in what we're doing. But, like many, we're unsuccessful because, I mean, you're looking for a needle in a haystack in the past. You're just following some rumor, some story, some shadow in the snow, hoping that one of the stories will pan out and you're in the right area. And just, you know, crossing off the possible places and eliminating those that weren't good. Ours is a whole different story. Now, in around 2005, 2006, they started this project at the Ma Wan theme park in Hong Kong to build a replica of Noah's Ark. It's been there the last 3 years. One of the group that was associated with that was a Hong Kong media enterprise, Sparkling Sun, and then NAMI. It's called Noah's Ark Ministries International, they call themselves. Supposedly evangelicals. I originally got involved with them because they were getting permits to climb Mount Ararat, which Americans couldn't get. And so we formed a partnership with them, put a great deal of money into it, because they were going to take our data from the satellite, get us on the mountain, and we were going to work together to find this. It ended up, they had a guy who was a Kurdish guy. He's not really a guy, not an alpinist. He has a sports shop there. And they were giving him a big retainer to help find things related to Noah's Ark. And it's just the whole industry there is to prey on people who have that kind of mentality. There are a lot of Kurds. It's a corrupt area like we were talking about with these other areas. And basically it's a very poor, illiterate culture in eastern Turkey. That's where the two earthquakes just happened right there in the Van area. Mud brick houses and other things just falling down. And so money is very important. And if you've got, you know, Americans and others with lots of money coming over and saying, help me find Noah's Ark, sure, I'll help you find it. You know, nothing's ever produced. They just get completely robbed. And that's what was happening in this case, I thought, until I found out now that the Chinese themselves were complicit in this. They wanted to build a movie set up in the mountain, about the 12,000-foot area, carried wood up there on the horses, a little short distance over from the sport climb area to build this, put it in parts of the glacier. It's an elaborate thing, but the pictures you're seeing, some of the pictures you're talking about, aren't on that mountain at all. It doesn't exist there. That's off-site. But we got one of our guys up last year there, took wood from it. The wood is modern wood, treated, burned. It doesn't look dark beneath the ice. Cut through it, it's just white pine. Every summer, the thing collapses because the area that's holding the wood melts and it just falls apart. Then they rebuild it when it gets cold again. And that's when they go up and take people and do various kind of things to show them this or show them that. They're very careful what they show them. No one's walked in big galleries or big rooms, all these things you've heard. Now, the organization is a very slick movie out. They had it in San Francisco recently. They're in different parts of the United States showing this. You can see it online. They've got millions and millions of dollars from Chinese churches from the U.S. now because they're trying to convince people they found Noah's Ark. The testing on the little wood that they have turned in, which they got from Esfahan, which is an old fortress in Iran. They brought this wood over, just small pieces, turned that in for testing. It tested about 2,000 years old, but that's not nearly old enough for the Ark. And Andrew Snelling, with Answers in Genesis, got hold of the copies of the testing. He's done a very elaborate analysis of this and said, can't be Noah's Ark, possibly could be Noah's Ark. Anything from the Ark, if it were actually tested by conventional means, would date to 50,000 years old. That's not 50,000 years old, it's 5,000 years old, but it's because of the rate calibration from before the flood. So that's why something that dates 2,000 years old can't possibly be it. We know about the fraud. We have people who have, we know the people who built the thing. We've talked to them. We've interviewed them. We have some of it on film, but some would lose their lives if we let their names out. I had two guys who came out and were willing to sign a document and give us their statement, and we put that out on the internet, and this guy Parachute, who's the Kurdish guide, he came and he threatened them, basically said, you'll never work again, other things. They went on Skype and said I was a liar and put all kind of things out. And there's all kind of, they have films and things released about me. They tried to, they put a lawsuit against me and against CBN when I did a program on CBN. They had some people write letters to our school, try to get me fired from the university and other places. This is a Christian group. And all because, really, they know that if we find the real thing, it'll ruin their scam. And they've got a lot going. Recently, a woman who spent a year there as a travel agent had got a lot of dirt on this, too. She's an atheist, but she's helping us with this expose. And they threatened to kill her. I've actually got the letter where they said they kill her. So and that's the kind of thing that's going on. The scams are there. I've written on my website, worldofthebible.com, there's a 40-50-page report with about 100 photographs, all kinds of films, other things, links to things on the internet. You'll find all this there if you want to read about that. So this year, I couldn't even stay in Dobiaza, which is right at the foot of Mount Ararat, because this parachute guy was gunning for me and another guy who's on the permit with us. We had to constantly move around. We're safe. We're on the mountain, off the mountain. You know, they could get us. So let me add that to the rest of the mix.
You mentioned Answers in Genesis.
Yes.
They have a project trying to replicate Noah's Ark.
Yeah.
You're involved in that at all?
No. Ken Ham's daughter goes to Liberty. I know her. Ken's been down there. It's a $27 million project to build a scale model of Noah's Ark at their creation museum. It'd be a wonderful thing to see. I'd rather see the real thing. But we're not actually, you know, you're not, as you were saying, we're not going to be able to bring any sizable piece of that back. I mean, sections or things, if we can, we will. But there's just no feasible way of doing it. We've fantasized about getting cable cars up there, or creating a glass roof over the thing and all, but it's not going to happen. That's a volatile part of the world. They're just not that kind of interest. This is a Muslim country. They believe in Noah's Ark, of course, but they don't want any Christian involvement or other involvement, so, and they fight among themselves.
My question's for Bill. Just a couple of issues in Washington. I'm curious what the latest buzz is on these. Is there any optimism about overthrowing Obamacare, either legislatively or judicially? And then the other thing I was curious about is there any latest developments on the International Criminal Court? I heard a lot about that a couple years back, and it's sort of, I haven't heard much about that. So
yeah, that's kind of died down. I haven't heard a lot about that. I know that the international community would love to have the United States part of that, but we're not there yet, as far as I can tell. As far as Obamacare, a lot of people are saying, why did the Supreme Court wait for as long as they have? They're going to discuss the case in the summer on what to do with it, whether it's constitutional or not. And really, they really should have addressed this immediately rather than let it linger like it has. I think that's going to be a very significant decision next summer. Right now, Kennedy has been the swing vote. We have probably four conservatives and four liberals, and Kennedy's going to be the swing vote. And they're trying to get Kagan dissolved, or whatever the proper word is, off the case, and that'll probably be a fight in its recused. Yeah, that'll be a battle in itself. So that's pretty much where it stands right now. But it's going to be contentious, and the decision is going to be right before the election, which is very interesting too.
I have two practical questions. I think I have some ideas of what I think myself. How do we harmonize the fact that we keep saying that there's no signs before the rapture? Then we talk about the signs of wars and rumors of wars and earthquakes, and we say these are signs of the end times. Then my second question would be, how can we as pre-tribulationalists avoid the embarrassment of talking about certain signs that are coming together and then they don't come together, and then there's ridicule for, like maybe how we treated Saddam Hussein or something like that.
Yeah, let's start with something.
That's for any of you.
Anyway, I'd say there's an old saying that the signs or the events that are going to come cast their shadows before them. So we're not looking at the signs of times now, but signs of things that will happen. In other words, we believe there are no events or signs of the tribulation occurring now, but there are things that are preparing for those events. So I think personally that Matthew 24, 9 through 15, that section there, or even earlier, all is the beginning of the tribulation, not in the time in which we're living now. Others disagree with that. They think all of that is occurring at this age. But in other words, the nearer we get, the more of the things we ought to see. But they're not clear. They're just, as I said, shadows. So we're guessing. We see the outline, but we don't see the full picture yet. The closer we get to the actual event, the clearer the picture becomes. So like Gog and Magog, for instance, we see all these allies aligning. We see them in the right geographical place. We see them aligning with each other, as the text says. We see, you know, Israel the target. All these things seem right, but we can't be quite sure of the time. And I think we seem to know more about it now than I think people have known in the past, just from the study of the text. There are things that are making the text clearer in many ways, simply from the political events. But we can't be absolutely sure. So I think we have to be cautious about that. But we shouldn't err to the end of not saying anything, not motivating ourselves to see what's going on around us. That would be also irresponsible, I think.
I think we probably have to be pretty circumspect when we're talking about these events that are unfolding. I keep going back to what Dr. Walford said, and he was in no way a sensationalist. He was a great scholar. And he would tell me time after time, and I've appropriated the phrase from him, we're seeing the stage being set for these prophecies to be fulfilled. Doesn't mean that it has to happen. But again, when you look at all of these indicators, and the signs are not for us, 1 Corinthians 1:22 said the signs are for the Jews. And when Jesus Christ gave Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, he was talking to Jewish people and focusing on the period of the tribulation after the rapture of the church. In fact, the rapture of the church at that time had never even been mentioned. None of these passages are dealing with the rapture of the church. They're dealing with the tribulation period after the rapture takes place. And so as I love the phrase that Randy used also, we see the shadow of the trees that are standing there. And in fact, in Matthew 24, verse 32, Jesus said, "Now learn a parable of a fig tree." And that's not talking about Israel. He's simply using his surroundings there on the Mount of Olives to discuss the issue and give credence to what he said. Learn a parable of a fig tree. When you see the leaves starting to have the limbs starting to have leaves on them, you can know summer is nigh. Likewise, when you see all these things happen, you'll know that it's at the door of the second coming of Christ. The generation that sees these things, that's not us, technically, that's the people in the tribulation period that he's talking to who will see those things happening. Howbeit, we're standing outside of that seven-year period of time, and we can see the things starting coming into focus. Another thought is, everything that we see, everything that Bill, myself, or Randy talked about, Randy not so much so because he was focused on Noah's Ark, but when Bill and I were talking everything that we've talked about, all the information that we've given you, that's never been like it in ever in history. We're living in a day like never before in history, and all of these things, every prophetic passage is seemingly coming right to fulfillment. And so we're seeing it happen, and I think that gives us credence to be careful not to say this is absolute, but it certainly does seem like this is about to happen. And I think we need to continue to encourage ourselves to study the passage. Study the text first. Use that as a spotlight or a telescope or a microscope on what we're looking at from a current event perspective. I think we get dangerously close to heresy when we start saying, well, this happened and I know it's absolutely what God's doing. Nobody in the world knows exactly what God's doing. Only God knows what he's doing. And he has a plan. Now, I do not see how in the world we're going to live another 100 years, another 50 years, another 25 years. I'll be amazed if we live till tomorrow on this earth. So I think we're at that point. And Dr. Walford, before he died, he said to me, I believe I'm going to see the rapture. Wow. He was, what, 96? 94. 94. He told me in a meeting, we were together speaking, he said, Jimmy, I believe I'm going to see the rapture before I die.
But he will. The dead in Christ will rise first.
Glory to God. No, I said before he died.
I know.
Oh, it's also really almost hard to comprehend as we are living in the most important time in Bible prophecy history with the least amount of interest in it by the church.
That's the bad news.
That is the bad news, Jimmy. Yeah. Absolutely. It amazes me. And, I work with, best I can tell, maybe 5 or 6 Christians at the White House in the correspondence pool, not many believers, but they're all from replacement theology churches. And when I talk to them about Israel and prophecy and final days, I mean, they glass over. It's like, boy, Bill, I hope I'm not living when this all happens. We're living in this time. Or they get really scared. Or they get real spooked. You know, that's another thing. We're very blessed that we are not fearful of these days. And I think if you don't already have a prophetic perspective, we have a lot of people that are very fearful. I've even seen that, you know, when we're talking 10, 15 years ago in prophetic events or prophecy events, that was maybe 8, 10, 15 years out. So it wasn't as intense. It wasn't as burdensome or bothersome. But now we're so close to these things, and things are happening so quickly in significant biblical areas that, you know, some people are just really freaked out about it. But we also have to, you know, as Christians, we can see these things. God's given us discernment, biblical discernment. And we also just can't operate out of fear. We cannot be fearful. God will be there. He will protect us however we need to be. He's going to be there for us. And if we see more and more of these things happen in our country, we're going to have to be the people with the joy of Jesus in our heart. We're going to have to be the ones that are all about Jesus. And we're going to have to lead people to the truth. We had 7 out of 10 Americans that were depressed after 9/11. And if we had another event or two right after 9/11, I mean, we were up against the ropes. That would have finished off a lot of people. But God in His mercy didn't allow that to happen. But there will be a day. And very likely, I think, after the Lord's taken us via the rapture, that we're going to see serious events like that. And the Bible talks about when men's hearts will fail them for what they're seeing. So, we just got to continue to pray for opportunities. It's never been more challenging to share the gospel in some places, especially when it comes to the inerrant word of God. We even have the Pope saying that the Bible's not the inerrant word of God. We have Protestant leaders saying the same thing. We're such a small part of the church. We've
got Dallas grads making that same statement.
And that's unbelievable, but true.
A couple questions for Jimmy. I was in Israel last year, and I was going up on the inside of the Eastern Gate and climbing up. And I heard these guys yelling at me. They're Muslims back there. And the higher I got, the louder they yelled. I didn't know they were yelling at me. But anyway, I got almost on top, and another guy comes out over the top. And he said, back, back. He's just really screaming. And I had taken all these pictures, so I go down, and they're coming towards me, and I thought, man, they're going to take my camera for whatever reason. So I scurried away, and then they backed off. First question is, why are they so paranoid about that? I was just taking close-up pictures of the Eastern Gate on the inside. The second question I have for you is, then I was walking over on Solomon Stables area towards the towards the wall, and I noticed as I was walking over there, that does not feel stable at all, walking over on. What's the information there? I mean,
well, underneath that area where you were walking to the southeast, correct? You're to the right to the left as you look at Al-Aqsa Mosque there. Underneath there's a 10,000 seat mosque. That's the reason that the Muslims went in there with backhoes and took all of that. They took 1,000 truckloads, 1,000 dump truckloads of materials. Randy, in his latest book, talks about Gabby Barkai, who has started a special sifting project because they took all of that archaeological remain, artifacts, and everything else, threw it in the city dump, and Gabby reclaimed it. Our son takes teenagers to Israel every year, and last year they went and worked in the project alongside Gabby. And we've done a lot of television, both John Ankerberg and Day of Discovery, with Gabby Barkai, a very interesting man, but has a wonderful mission, and he has people coming from all over Israel going in there and sifting through the archaeological remains. Now, Randy can tell us, as an archaeologist, you don't use a backhoe to do your excavation. You use a spoon. But, and so I don't know how it's going to qualify. You could maybe speak to that. But that's what's down there. And interestingly also, that southern retaining wall has been weakening. Maybe you saw the scaffolding there, but also the eastern retaining wall, both at where the
patches on them.
Yeah, southern and the eastern retaining wall come together. Which the Israelis wanted to go in and repair. They wouldn't allow them to do it. The Jordanians are supposed to come over and do it. You know, that could very well give way, and I'm praying that that's going to happen because that would bring the Dome of the Rock down as everything's shuffled down into the Kidron Valley.
I'll tell you.
Go ahead.
There's a paranoia over this because it is now Islamic dogma that no temple ever existed there. It has absolutely nothing to do with Israel. There's not a single stone in Israel that indicates, or in Jerusalem, that indicates a Jewish history. So why would people even care to go up there? Why are the Jews up there? Why are the Christians up there? It can't be for archaeological reasons. It can't be for historical reasons. There must be some other reason. And they go back still to when Dennis Ronan, this cultist with the Children of God, came up there and set fire to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and they believe that that was complicit with the State of Israel, that the State of Israel has, as a stated belief, we want to tear down all the buildings that are there so we can rebuild the Third Temple. That's very far from the government's point of view, but they believe that because that's what they would do if the situation was different. And so when you have people prowling around there, going around there, looking at things, you know, they believe the worst. They believe that they're, who knows what you're doing. And so it's just, I mean, if you do it and you get your name written down, you're never going to get back in there. They're very strict about that. Same reason you can't, I mean, it's only for Islam. It has nothing to do with Jews or Christians. So if you carry a Bible on there, you're not allowed to do that anymore. You can't bring a notebook or anything that has a picture of the temple on it. You can't pray on the site. You even try. You have people watching your lips to make sure you're not saying a prayer, and they'll escort you off the site. Very strict about the control. And that's all, since Ariel Sharon went up there, they closed the site for 3 years. They reopened it because they set a very unhealthy precedent against the status quo in doing that. And so now tourists can go up there, but the Muslims close access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock. So they don't like people being up there at all. They don't think they should be up there, but they can't counter what the government's doing. And so they're going to police that and keep you from any area.
You're not allowed to carry a commercial camera up there.
No, not.
Albeit, my video out there shows me teaching from right there beside the Dome of the Rock. So That was a God thing, and I have to know that for sure. The other thought, just to add what, and Randy was right on target with the Islamic Trust that's responsible for the custodial responsibilities up there. But they're a bunch of radical young people. I don't know what age they were, but some of them endeavor to try to develop some kind of a power against anybody that's not one of them. And that could have been that radical element as well, but most likely it was what Randy said.
Okay, this is for Bill and Jimmy. I know that Iran is probably the biggest threat to Israel, but what I'm expecting next is Psalm 83. And you remember 2 years ago they were firing the rockets from Gaza over into Israel, and Israel was, you know, chasing them back and so forth. Well, I can see on the news racks of these little rockets in southern Lebanon on the regular nightly news, and nobody talks about them. And we know that in Damascus there's over 50,000 of these little rockets. Doesn't anybody talk about this?
Well, the Prime Minister does. Prime Minister Netanyahu makes it very plain. When I was in one of the news conferences with him, he said that what the numbers were and what was actually going on. And when you start to think about when the battle took place between Hezbollah and the Israeli Defense Force, they had about, I think, 12,000 rockets that they fired over into Israel. Now it's up to, I've heard, latest I heard was 60,000 that they have available right now. When you look at Hamas, who is the other surrogate for Iran in the southern portion of the country, they're firing Grad missiles into mainland Israel. And I saw one in Ashdod, which had landed there. The remains of it still there. A Grad missile is produced in Iran. And so they're getting across the Egyptian border there these munitions in to be able to do it. But people are talking about it, but you got to factor in Hezbollah in the north and Hamas in the south if indeed Israel does make a preemptive strike. There was one former general, who the head of the Israeli Air Force, who was the chief of staff during the time up there when they went into southern Lebanon against Hezbollah. And today he said in Harut 7 that the next thing we're going to have to do is take a bulldozer and bulldoze the Gaza Strip. Because he said we're not going to be able to sustain an existence here with everything that's going on in the Gaza Strip.
Does anybody in Washington worry about these rockets?
They're worried. That's one of those. We'll try to get a Washington answer here. Yeah. Right, a politically correct. Been back there too long. I think the big thing right now is the United States is worried about Israel responding to these rockets and missiles. That's probably the greatest concern right now that we have. In Washington, and as Panetta, I mean, literally was just there a couple weeks ago. Then he was at the Saban Forum last weekend and saying, get back to the you-know-what table. And, they want to know if Israel is going to attack first, but Israel will be a fool to tell the United States.
Of course. Listen, the chief of staff of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff made a statement on Wednesday. Israel is not going to probably inform us if they're going in.
Yeah, well, that's right on. Right on. You know, we don't even risk telling Obama, then, you know, having Iran sit there waiting for the attack. But, the big thing here, and there's a couple scenarios. Are we going to have all these conflicts with Israel's neighbors and possibly even Gog Magog first? Or another great possibility is a war between Shia and Sunni. I saw a scenario the other day. It was pretty amazing how Iran has positioned themselves in western Yemen, right there at the Red Sea, how they're around the oil in Saudi Arabia. They have a lot of influence in Pakistan. There's been a lot of cooperation developing their nuclear missile. They're working on that right now, as well as the bomb. So there is so much cooperation with Iran and Bahrain, our fifth fleet's there. Iraq, look at them moving in there. They're funding Hezbollah. You know, if somebody takes Syria out of them, I mean, they got a pretty good thing going, and they're very smart, they're very strategic, and they're very patient, and they are much smarter than the Sunnis, the Iranian. They're very smart people.
I don't see the Sunni-Shiite fight, though. And the reason I don't see it is because if your enemy is my enemy, we're friends. And both groups hate the Jews, and they want to get rid of the Jews. I see too much cooperation. Hamas is Sunni, and they've had over 1,000 of the Hamas terrorists train in Tehran. And so Tehran and what's going on there is giving too much cooperation to the Sunnis across the world as well. Now, some of them, especially Saudi Arabia, they are scared, like you said, they are scared to death what could happen. But I don't see that coming about before the prophetic scenario in God's
Word. Yeah, the cooperation, that's true, Jimmy. The cooperation is very interesting because Muslim Brotherhood basically took over there. I mean, the Iranians were in there immediately.
Exactly.
It was shocked a lot of people in Washington, our brilliant guys in Washington, and a lot of people, the fact that they got in there and they were working out of their differences. And even to the extent of the Shia in Iraq had a bad relationship with the Shia of Iran, well, they've worked out their differences too. But the common enemy is always Israel, and that's always the one they have a desire for. But there's also this apocalyptic cult, as Joel would say, in Iran, has some very significant plans. And it's like a cornered animal. They're seeing Syria possibly being pulled out of the axis. They're seeing all these things happen with inside of Iran, these mysterious events. It's going to be really interesting. 2012 is going to be an extremely interesting year. And I think even if we predicted today what's going to happen the next 12 months before the next year's preacher, we wouldn't even be close. That's just the nature of the area.
Based upon what we've been learning here, we won't see 2012.
Yeah, very, very possible. Right, you're in charge of pulling us. So.
I have two questions. One for Jimmy. Within the last year or so, you gave us a report that there had been a sighting of the Ark of the Covenant underneath the Temple Mount. Do you have any update on that?
Well, on this video out here, I have both Shlomo Goren and Yehuda Getz saying that they went to the Ark of the Covenant. And then I have Gershon Solomon saying that Yehuda Getz called him at 2 a.m. in the morning. He got so excited, he said, we've found the Ark of the Covenant. You can just look at the video. Don't do with what I say and see what he says. It's on that little thing I gave you as well, the CD, if you got one of those. And he didn't even put his shoes on. He drove right over there, and they went right to the spot, opened the gate, and right there in that area. Now, he didn't say he saw the Ark of the Covenant, but they went to it. When I listened to, and I know Randy had some conversations, I think, with Yehuda Getz as well.
And Goren, both.
But both of those men, after I did that video, that first video, they were told by the Temple Institute to shut up and not to talk to anybody. And so Randy talked to them after that. So I can't, you know, Randy can tell you what they said, but I know that they started totally backing off of everything they said. But you can make your own decision. Min Okalashir interviewed him, and he said what was in the Ark. So, you know.
Well, Randy, was there any, did they say anything different to you?
Yeah. Seemed to be in a, you know, he said, she said kind of situation.
Which one was she?
Well, your source is my source. But look, I four times interviewed Yehuda Getz, all on film. We asked him specifically this question, and I had Chaim Rich from the Temple Institute with me when we asked it. And it was all done in Hebrew, but we asked him this stuff, and he said we never saw the Ark. We never got close to it. We were at least a year away from it. He said we think we know where it is. He talked about hearing the breathing of the Shekinah. He talked about finding this kind of bug that was mentioned in the Talmud. He talked about all kind of stuff. But he said, no. He said, I want people to know we never saw it. And I, you know, the reason I brought Chaim with me was because I wanted him there to hear what he said. And we were talking, and he said, never heard anything different. That's the case. Gershon said the same thing to me. He said, yes, he went, but not because they found the Ark, they were working at night on this thing, and he went to do this. I mean, all I know is what I was told. Shlomo Goren, I was with him just about 7 months before his death, and same thing. He said, no, we didn't find it. He said, it's there. He made no question that it's there. But they repeatedly, to this exact question, said, we did not see it. And I've heard the rumors about using a mirror and looking around the corner and all these kind of things. But I'm just saying, this is what they told me. You know, so that's the best I can say. We were trying to get to the truth of the matter. And I don't know that they were compromised by anybody. It's just the fact they said, we had dug about a year, and we need another year to get to it. So.
And you just go out there and pick up my video and listen to it.
I'll do that.
And
I have them on my video, too. Say the other thing.
Let me just finish. Yeah. You go out there, and Shlomo Goren said we were within 25 feet. He makes that statement as plain as could be made. You can listen to Gershon Solomon. Now, somebody's lying to somebody because Gershon Solomon said we went and the gate was open and we could have, all we had to do was clean up some trash and we'd have been there. Not a year away. That phrase was never used. But Chaim Richman has really turned against the evangelicals.
Oh.
And he's got his own thing going. He does temple talk. And he doesn't want anything to do with evangelicals at all, Christians at all. And I think that that's a part of the whole debate that's going on. Forget both of them. 2 Chronicles 35:3 says the ark is there.
Yeah, we don't have any question that we think it's there.
Yeah,
I'm just not sure what they saw.
But isn't this based on their belief, their rabbinic belief, that the Ark of the Covenant was hid away before?
It's based on 2 Chronicles 35:3, which is Bible.
I understand, but I listened to a 2-hour show that Chaim Richman did. I have it on my iPod years ago, and he didn't mention the Bible at all. He was simply saying that all this rabbinic tradition that they believe that the Ark of the Covenant was buried under, that Solomon knew that Israel would apostatize, and he built a chamber in it, and then 100 years or something before the Babylonians came, they took it down there and put it in and sealed it up and all of this.
Their basis, for that, though, is 2 Chronicles 35:3.
Yeah,
right.
But it is rabbinic tradition, and it's based on this belief that Goren told me. He said, we couldn't have had Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, if we didn't have the Ark of the Covenant. So even though it was hidden away at the time of the destruction of the first temple, and it wasn't brought out in the second temple, it's quite clear. Josephus says a barren stone was there. They poured the sacrificial blood on it. Then he says underneath was the Ark of the Covenant because they knew it was there, then still had the efficacy. You know, but that's what they claim. They said otherwise Yom Kippur would have been abated, and because the essential part is the high priest putting blood on the mercy seat of the ark, there's no ark, how do you have it? So that was one of his arguments.
Temple Institute, when you go there with your tour group, even the girls who are doing the guiding say, we know where the Ark of the Covenant is. Now, they're not the smartest people in the world, but they're giving the company line.
I mean, Jewish sources tell us where it is. It's beneath the pin of wood. There was an entrance there. They believe it's beneath probably somewhere where the Dome of the Rock is today, underneath in the chamber there. So they actually have these kind of sources pinpointed, but you know, you have to be able to fit that on a modern map, and that's another struggle.
Who's the archaeologist who did the tunnels?
Dan Bahat was the director of it.
Mayor Ben Dove told me on video also that, and he made this statement on a Day of Discovery television program, and Marty Hahn is far from being a sensationalist. He made this statement that indeed Goren came to him afterwards and told him they found the Ark of the Covenant. So, you know, you got everybody saying everything.
Okay. One other question for Bill, if I may. You mentioned about this new virus, the Dooku virus, is that what they call it?
Can you
elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, what I read on it, it's a Dooku virus, and it's something that's kind of an offspring of Stuxnet, according to Semitech, one of the top virus experts. And it is going, I've heard it will, I've heard two things. I heard earlier this week that every key punch on a computer, it will be able to monitor, and also will be able to monitor the activity beyond that of what those computers are involved with. And by understanding what those computers are involved with, having to do with their nuclear program, then they can put language in there to counter that somehow or another. It's just, this is godly brilliance. Israelis in the United States, they worked on Stuxnet. New York Times eventually came out with it in one of our facilities up in Idaho. They developed this incredible thing called Stuxnet. And it's been remarkable. And now they're developing things that play off Stuxnet. And it creates a lot of havoc within the computer systems
without,
of Iran.
Without firing a shot, they've just done all this disruption.
A 13-year-old boy did it. He was a hacker.
I can believe that.
Probably.
Thank you very much.
Probably. If you have a problem, find a teenager. They'll fix it in a second. Why waste hours?
Hey, Tom, are y'all double-teaming us here? Isn't that your wife getting ready to ask a question? Y'all are double-teaming us here, man.
Well, I had a question. No one else has asked the question. It's directed more to Bill. I'd like to know, since he's up there in Washington, what the climate is for the GOP candidates running for president. You know, they're attacking everybody.
It's ugly. It's going to get really bad. It's already bad. It's going to get worse. The Democrats and the liberal media, which is four of our five major networks, are going to do everything they can to help Obama get reelected. They are vetting every single Republican candidate. As soon as they take a lead, watch out, here it comes. If they had vetted Obama like this when he was running for office, he would have never got the Democratic nomination. He would have never been elected president, and he wouldn't have the chance of being a second-term president. It is amazing. But this perspective, the Republican takeover of the House during the last election in 2010 was a conservative takeover, where in 1994 it was a moderate takeover. It's very significant. And I think the Republican conservatives are going to gain many more seats in the 2012 election. A high probability they'll get control of the Senate, because 23 out of the 33 that are up for re-election are Democrats, and a fair amount of them are not even going to run again. So if the Republicans have a very significant majority in the House and the Senate, they need the White House in order to overturn Obamacare. I mean, that's something that's going to be extreme. That'll be about the only chance you get it when you have all three branches of our government that are Republican. So I was thinking this week, just think of what the young people in America are watching in Washington, D.C. What a sideshow. I remember when I was growing up, I respected our senators and congressmen, and they used to be able to work together. This is an embarrassment that we have in Washington, D.C. It is ridiculous, whether it's the media that's built these people up or whether it's the behavior. And the words that are spoken by our leaders who created this mess, there isn't a single problem America is not facing today that did not start in Capitol Hill or with the help of the White House. And we're paying the price, but we can't get rid of them. And part of the problem is the Republicans have a lot of faults, too. We had a huge 50% run-up in the size of our government during George W. Bush's 8 years in office. We blew it. And it's fiscally irresponsible. And the problem right now is there are so many people in the gravy train. Anybody that's pulled off, it has a ripple effect through a very weak economy. And you know, we have an 8.5% unemployment rate, but effectively it's probably closer to 15 to 16% because people are not looking any longer, or they're taking less of a job with their credentials and their backgrounds. So Washington, you know, the American people really do have a clue what the problem is, but we can't get rid of the problem. And I just hope and pray we will at some point. Maybe it's too late.
One of the interesting things to me is within 24 hours, any Republican candidate, if something comes out on him that's dirt, they know every detail about it.
Oh, yeah.
But yet, in 7 years, they haven't found out where the president was born, where he went to school, how he has operated, what papers he wrote. I don't know what's wrong. I mean, there's something there. Let me ask you a question. Right. Inside the Beltway political operation against Newt, does he have a chance against them? And my follow-up question is, who do you think is in the lead now? Who do you think may have it?
Well, that's a good question on Newt. I mean, Pelosi's already said yesterday that she was in closed-door meetings and she's going to release a lot of this stuff, and supposedly it's public information, so it can be released. And then Gingrich says, oh, this is an early Christmas present. Yeah. So I'm sure he has a lot on Pelosi, but see, that's part of the problem. They have it on each other. I mean, this is so ridiculous. But Gingrich... I agree with a lot of what he says, but he has a history of being on both sides of debates and questions. So all these sound bites, all these things he said over the last 20-plus year, we're going to hear them. They're going to come out. And you're right. They have files on every candidate. Ron Paul's starting to move up. I mean, he could move up again. Then they'll be attacking Ron Paul for things he said. But that's what I don't like right now. It's like McCain said today, too many debates. The politicians need to be out with the people. They need to be, having rapport with the people. This debate every week is just ridiculous. And it's not helping anybody. And at the same time, I mean, if a Republican says one wrong thing, it's sound bites for 3 to 5 days. A Democrat, no problem, they get away with it. And that's really our biggest problem. Our media is electing the candidates. They build them up, or they tear them down, and it's a sad day for our America that's the way it is.
Are you talking about those correspondents at the White House?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. One thing I found from being at the White House for 11 years, the nicer someone is, the more conservative. The meaner they are, the more liberal they are. I told this new Jewish correspondent with Newsweek that, and he's a young guy, and he's just like, really? I said, you watch. You're new here. The nicer, the more conservative. The meaner, the more liberal. And that's really the way it is. That's the best test.
No one's talked a whole lot about the Psalm 83 question. To me, that's a really, really interesting theory that I think we ought to consider more as a real possibility. I know Arnold Fruchtenbaum's already... mentioned it before in the past, and of course Bill Salas's book Israelistein has brought this theory forward, and I'd like to hear what you guys say about that.
Repeat what you said at the beginning.
I said
Psalm 83.
Psalm 83.
Psalm 83. Okay.
Yeah, as prophecy.
You go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Well, I take a pretty tough stand. I believe Psalm 83, Daniel 11, and Ezekiel 38 are the same conflict. And they just simply add over in, for example, Psalm 83, I think it's verse 6, it says the Ishmaelites. And the Ishmaelites have to be Saudi Arabia today because that's the only nation they established. Genesis chapter 17 and verse 20, Genesis chapter 25, verse 18. So they're a part of what's going to be the mix for the alignment of the nations. It also mentions Tyre, which is modern-day Lebanon. They're a major player. And then when you look at the other list of nations, it looks very much like other nations that have already been mentioned when you go back and start to exegete it there. In addition to that, you look at verse 4. It says the council comes together in Psalm 83, and they come out and say, we must wipe Israel off the face of the earth that her name be forgotten forever. Well, that's a direct quote from what Ahmadinejad said back July the 9th in 2006 before Hezbollah attacked Israel. So I think they all go together. Daniel 11, you come down to verse 43, then it starts mentioning Libya, Ethiopia, and then from the north and from the south. Now, from the north is not Syria because they've been wiped out in that passage, and from the south is not Egypt because they've been wiped out. And so we're talking about the other players in Ezekiel chapter 38.
Yeah, I did a four-article series on the Psalm 83 thing, and I don't buy it at all, Bill Salas's view. First of all, there's not one prophecy in the entire psalm. It's a corporate lament psalm in which he is crying out to God for 3,000 years ago in the time of David about the enemies that surrounded Israel. Now, there are similar psalms. Why isn't Psalm 2 a separate battle? In other words, why do we think Psalm 83 is somehow a separate autonomous battle? When you read his book, he doesn't give any biblical reasons. He basically suggests that it solves some problem, and then he goes on and paints a scenario as if this is a prophecy, and it's not even a prophecy. It's a request. And I would then argue in the progress of Revelation, you have, I call them the synoptic prophets. In other words, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel's kind of like John. It's different than the other prophets. All three of those synoptic prophets have sections where they talk about the judgment of the nations. So early on, you have Israel crying out in the Psalms for God to protect them. Then you have the prophets talking about prophecies where this is going to be fulfilled. And so all of these nations that are mentioned in Psalm 83 are mentioned in the judgment of the nations, which basically is going to happen in Armageddon. And so you have 11 chapters in Isaiah, you have 9 chapters in Jeremiah, something like that, and 7 or 8, and they're parallel to each other. And they mention these nations, and they're going to be judged at Armageddon when all the nations of the world are going to be judged. And so I don't see Psalm 83 as some possible war. Otherwise, why not make Psalm 2 a separate war by itself? You see, Psalm 2 is a similar prophetic thing. Why not Psalm 79? Why not Psalm 84? These are also lament psalms, crying out, and all of this kind of stuff. No, I know why, because it seems when you read it, like what's happening today. And I agree, that was happening 3,000 years ago, and it's happening today. But when you look and cross-reference these nations, then the Bible later puts them in a prophetic context in which that God is going to answer their prayer. And so I think it's a great mistake to see Psalm 83 as some autonomous war that's going to set the stage for Gog and Magog and all of that kind of stuff. And I don't think Arnold Fruchtenbaum supports this as some war. He just saw some connections, and they take his little quote and expand it into, I wish he was here, he could comment on it, and expand that into somehow he's supporting all of the ideas and concepts that Bill Salas has come out with. But that's just my humble opinion.
And I humbly agree with you. Is Bill here, by the way?
Bill, you touched a hot button with me about the politics in Washington, and what is going on excites the prophet in me. And I would like for you to address for a moment the coming election. If I understand it correctly, we have opportunity to replace 2/3 of the Senate and the White House. There are supposedly 140 million professing Christians in the United States. And we could get the message out that those 140 million people could take their God into the voting booth. Maybe we could turn this around. I'd like for you to address that for a moment. And number two, it's a change of pace just for a tad. But I'm sitting here during the conference this weekend, or this week, and I read my first Bible prophecy book at 21. I was 21 years old, and it captivated. It got a hold of me, and it's never let go. But when I look around me, I don't see any more 21-year-olds. The young people are checked out on this message. Where are they, and what can we do to go get them? Okay.
Let me just say, this is the last question, and so all of y'all, if you have closing comments, Bill, you can answer that question, and then any closing comments by the rest of the guys, and then we'll wrap it up.
Gary, I think the Obama received half the Protestant vote,
yeah.
half the Catholic vote, 90% of black American vote, and that's a lot of believers in that
yes,
group,
absolutely.
Tons of believers, and 25% of the evangelicals.
Yeah.
And I think it's anywhere from 15 to 20 million Christians just didn't even bother to go to the polls. You know, we don't vote on these moral issues anymore. I mean, these moral issues is our foundation in our country. And there's a lot of friends of mine right now, even in the black community, that are, you know, not real happy about President Obama's position on abortion, his promotion of the LGBT agenda. No one has done more. No world leader has done more to promote that than him and Hillary Clinton. And it's had a major impact in our country and throughout the world. And that's huge. And the God of Israel is not going to sit there forever and not allow some form of judgment. We're already in judgment. But as far as very serious, significant judgment, most people say that's the second half of the tribulation. But I'm thankful we had a conservative take over the House. That's a blessing. The Senate, I think, is going to go very conservative. But we really do need the White House. And it's kind of what Jimmy was alluding to. I really don't know who the candidate's going to be right now. Unfortunately, the Republican Party has not had as strong candidates for president. Bob Dole was weak. President Bush ran against Al Gore. He was not a super-duper campaigner and a debater, but he ran against Al Gore. And then he was flying off popularity, so he was able to beat John Kerry, who was relatively weak as well. And then Giuliani and Romney were the selections of the Republican establishment. Giuliani backed out. Romney got no traction. Huckabee won in Iowa. So all of a sudden, the establishment is freaked out. And they say, we got to support McCain. So that's how McCain became the candidate. And he kind of, the last 4 to 6 weeks, McCain had a close election. He was picking up momentum. And then the financial crisis, he said, I'm stopping the debate. I'm going to Washington. We're going to fix everything. And he made a mess of it. I mean, he didn't do anything, and Obama and George W. Bush were the ones that were doing peace between the Republicans and Democrats. So with all of that said, I don't have any idea. I mean, today Gingrich is the guy that's up in the polls. But he's got a lot of baggage. An evangelical leader said last week, you better address your marriage situation, your three marriages, now, and get it out in the open rather than letting this thing linger. But I just wish we had a stronger Republican candidate, and we don't.
To confirm what Bill said, my daughter-in-law, Jimmy's wife, our oldest son's wife, is a political operative here in the state of Texas. She's in San Antonio. She's probably going to run the campaign for the next mayor of San Antonio. She's run several congressional campaigns, and she has the stats. He said 25% of Obama's vote, and what put him over McCain was the born-again evangelical Christians. And I reported to you earlier tonight, even Wikipedia is making the statement that Ed Dobson, a Bob Jones graduate, a staff member at Jerry Falwell's, a former member of the Moral Majority, voted for Obama because he was the most Christ-like. And that's his statement. And so, you know, it doesn't matter how many supposed Christians we have here in America. Now, the other thing, you ask about the teenagers. I was talking earlier when I was mentioning Ed and I first met each other back in the mid-70s. We were going in, what was the guy's name? Youth pastor, Youth of Flame. Can you think? You guys, what? No, who was it? Liberty. Gordon Love. Who was actually with Jerry right from the very outset and started Youth for Flame, we would have 3,000 teenagers in the mid-70s there. And that's where I started. You remember a couple of years ago, I did my walk through Revelation in 3.5 minutes. That's where I started teaching Revelation to all teenagers. But youth pastors today are not worried about teaching the truth. They're worried about entertaining teenagers. And being cool. Yeah, exactly. That's where our problem is. You know, we need to get the pastors to wake up. Pastors, most pastors in the churches I visit, have no idea what the youth pastor or the music guy is doing. I don't think they meet with them ever. And so, you know, I'm come there to preach, and they say, oh, we're going to take the teenagers. They'll go to the gym while you're preaching. Now, how stupid is that? How stupid is it? That's the problem. Again, that's what I was talking about when I was giving an evaluation of Ed. Forget the Middle East. That's the good news. The bad news is the church and what's going on. That's the bad news.
Absolutely. Yep.
Well, I got the last word. So first, just a comment. I don't like the idea of a presidential candidate that's had three wives.
Yeah.
I like less the idea of a presidential candidate whose church historically said you can have three wives at the same time. I can't imagine having a man as president and 50,000 to 100,000 Mormon missionaries going door to door and say, can I talk to you about the faith of your president?
Yeah.
Okay, that's just not, in my mind, going to happen. But, all right, now, about the church. Listen, Gary, when you and I were about the same age, and we were in church, we heard people preaching about the second coming of Christ.
Yeah.
I was 16 years old in 1967. I was watching the Six-Day War unfold on TV, and I was taken to a Baptist church where a guy was going through the book of Revelation verse by verse, and he was connecting the dots. And I came to faith. I said, you know, if this is really happening, you know, I don't want to be
late.
You bet. All right. Most of us, well, this is an in-house type of meeting, a think tank for the guys who are the media and the guys who are on the scholars or whatever. And we're kind of, we go into the churches. We don't go into many churches. Less and less.
Yeah, I
mean, the Calvary Chapels are having some of us in. Now and then a few Bible churches, some Baptist churches are catching on. Assembly of God, some others, you know. But really, less and less. And the fact is, you people who are in the churches need to rise up and demand of your pastors that you have the whole counsel of God, and part of the whole counsel of God is the prophetic scriptures. You can't avoid that. These are the times and the explanation. We want to have a biblical worldview. It's got to encompass the times in which we live. And so if you don't get the people to, you know, I get calls now and then because people have done that. One church, I won't mention it, but it's a Baptist church, and there was a guy who was real irritant. He wore his pastor to death. They hadn't had prophets in that church probably in 30 years. But he wore this guy out, and finally he brought me in, you know, and kind of set a fire. And they're talking about doing it again, but because we got numbers. We got more people in the church than they'd had in a long time. Because there are people who are interested, and they did enough advertising. But if you do it, then a pastor gets over the fear of all the nuts coming out of the woodwork and everybody challenging him about something he doesn't know anything about and all of that. But give him the positive side. Tell him how it affects lives. Make him see the practical side of prophecy. You know, but it has to come from that. We've got to get it back in the churches. And then we have young people who catch the flame and they want to go get trained in this. And they want to come and they're the next generation to carry it on. We've got to have it done. So you're the answer.
Yeah, amen. We're going to say goodnight, but on my table, if you got that free CD if you want it, and then the other videos.